101 WRIF Detroit. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Pleasure to be with you on this Sunday night. Sunday night here in the Motor City. We're streaming worldwide, so who knows? Some people are listening at 6 a.m. somewhere around the world, but wherever, welcome to the broadcast. We're going to talk about a lot of subjects tonight, including Bush endorsing teaching what's called intelligent design in schools. You know what that is. Sort of some quasi-religious deal, and that would have equal status with evolution. And we're going to continue with many of the themes that we've talked about over the months. Some of you have complained. You say, all you do is bash Bush. I think I'm going to stop bashing Bush. His popularity is so low, the support for the war is so low. Didn't I say this last week? I think I did. That it's only the fascists and the dopes that kind of still support it unequivocally. There's a lot of polls to show that the people have a lot of doubts, that they have ambivalences. In other words, some people think that, I can't understand these polls. Some people think that Bush has lied about everything about Iraq, but they still think we did not make a mistake in going there. So I'm not including you in that. But the people, the hardcore, no matter what could come out, no matter what's bit of information about either Bush or about the war or whatever, would still support him. So it's down to about 38%. That's rock bottom, hardcore. I mean, that's it. I mean, once you get beyond anywhere from 33 to 38%, then you start getting other people involved. I mean, you get that aren't hardcore or aren't, when I say dopes, and I mean, that's a little disparaging. I mean, that people really aren't paying much attention to all the news and all the information, but still have these very strong opinions. I mean, they just happen to see a headline, you know, a crawler at the bottom of Fox News, and they go, yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, I mean, without really looking at all this. I mean, unfortunately, in this country, you have to be pretty diligent to get accurate information. Can I gloat a little? Is not it true that everything that the critics, for instance, of the war have said about it is accurate? But that's nothing new. That's absolutely nothing new. When you talk about the other unjustified wars, say of the 20th century, that were condemned by critics, World War One. Yeah, we all know why the United States entered World War One, right? What was it? Oh, yeah, well, or I don't know. It must have been some good reason. But any event, little smaller skirmishes, but also Vietnam, and now this. First off, when the critics start, they say, this is nonsense. This is nothing the United States should be involved in. This is based on lies. Then what they're denounced as being unpatriotic in World War One. At that time, it was just terrible what went on. Critics were prosecuted, put in jail. They were tortured. They were their places, like, for instance, unions and all that, were had their headquarters raided by mobs. People were lynched because they had the temerity to say there was no good reason for the United States entering World War One. Well, when you come to Vietnam, same thing. You know, love it or leave it and all of that. Well, always, I guess I said there's other wars, but the critics of some of the big conflicts of that era of the 20th century turned out to be absolutely right. So I would just suggest, and there's a word that many of you have heard it, methodology. In other words, all of us have a methodology. How do we discern what is reality? How do we figure out what's true and what isn't true? Well, I suggest that one of the things that is necessary for a thinking person's arsenal, and you have to have an arsenal because people are always trying to take advantage of you politically, is a healthy dose of cynicism. That's where criticality begins. A guy in a suit gets on television and he says, fill in the blanks. And if you go, yes, that must be true, and we hate those people and we must invade their country because they represent such a threat to our way of life because the leader on TV said so, yeah, you're just fodder for any type of manipulation. So first thing is one steps back and we say, what's the history here? What information do I have now? What symbols are being manipulated in order to reduce my critical faculties? I hope I don't have to spell every bit of this out, but particularly with television and the majesty of the office of president surrounded by flags and the kind of gravity that's given to official announcements, that's kind of hard to overcome. Particularly the nature of television is that the world is presented as a spectacle. You, the sole, lone, atomized individual, is this passive receptor of this carefully crafted propaganda. I don't like the word propaganda. Speech. Whatever. Every politician does it. He's speaking, was it Goebbels who said, we don't speak to communicate the truth, we speak for effect? Something like that. That's not an exact quote. But in other words, what they want to do is to move you in a particular way. I mean, so do I. I mean, so do you when you talk to me in person or when you call 313-298-WRIF. I mean, you're trying to convince me, and you know thousands and thousands of other people are listening. So everybody's trying to convince everyone. But there are certain mechanisms that have greater power. I don't want a better word than that, but I'll stick with that. A greater power than others. Because television is the official medium of this society. And there are certain offices that although we say we have a secular country, presidents are treated like royalty. All their pictures adorn the White House, and their pictures are on, their representations are on our money. Statues of them are everywhere. It's almost like royalty. So when they speak, there's a tendency for people to believe them. Because people don't want to think that the most powerful person in our country, someone that was elected or selected or however they got into office, is going to just out and out lie to us. But let me say that the most important aspect to begin with when examining political and social affairs is cynicism. Wait a bit. Figure it out. Don't leap to conclusions. Don't jump into positions that you're then going to be stuck with, and then a year later or 5 years later or something like that, you're going to have to say, well, gee, I guess I made a little bit of a mistake there. Part of that goes back to what we were talking about last week, and I don't know if I even made my point fully. And that is, we were talking about the debate that continues to this day about the decision to drop atomic weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And in many ways, the point of me bringing it up was exactly what I was just talking about, is to question received knowledge. To question received knowledge. I mean, it's important, obviously, for, I don't know. You know, I think about a lot of these things I'm saying, I'm thinking about this as I go along. So if I stumble, it's because I'm not an authoritarian. I'm thinking, when I start to say something, I think, yeah, but, so there's a little bit of doubt. And that's good, too. I don't trust people that believe anything 100%. People that don't have a little edge of skepticism about their own beliefs. Because that means they're never going to re-examine them, no matter what you tell them. That's like the 38% Bush's support around the war. You can't convince them. There's nothing you could tell them. No information, no set of circumstances. They're there because they're the true believers. Anyway, so that was the idea that I had every August when I bring this subject up, is that when I say there was not a good military reason for dropping atomic weapons on Hiroshima, I want you right away say, oh yeah, there was, because if we didn't invade, that we would have lost 1 million men. Right? I mean, that's the received knowledge. And people that are 13 and 14 have that. People that are 54 and 64 and 74 that are listening have that. Because that was the official pronouncement. And it's still being defended. There are eminent historians that agree that it was militarily necessary. Certainly, the press has gone to really to bat big time this time around. You know, this was, I thought maybe this was this obscure subject I was bringing up, but it turns out Time Magazine, Newsweek, all these big publications repeated the official story that without this horrible slaughter of Japanese civilians, many of them who are captive of this fascist nation. I mean, the idea is always that that everyone was behind the Japanese fascist government and the emperor 100%, just like they believe that everyone was behind Hitler 100%. Well, we don't even know that, but we know there was great opposition in Germany. Hitler in 1932 got something like, 38% of the vote, or something akin to that. So we don't know. We do know. We can extrapolate from that, that there was continuing opposition. Anyways, Hiroshima marked the 60th anniversary on Saturday, the first atomic bomb attack, with prayers and water for the dead and a call by the city's mayor for nuclear powers to abandon their arsenals and stop jeopardizing human survival. They tasted nuclear warfare, whether they deserved it or not. Forget about that part of the discussion. They're calling upon the nations of the world that rather than developing atomic weapons led by the United States and really enabled by the United States and in some ways pushed by the United States under George Bush particularly to continue this arms race. So you have now the possibility of as many as 20 nations being able to develop nuclear weapons. Just a little bit to the argument. One of the first group of what they call revisionist historians, people that revise the official histories of any given subject. Man's name is Gar Alperovitz. I should have put this on my website because it's a hard name. Gar, first name, G-A-R, then Alperovitz, A-L-P-E-R-O-V-I-T-Z. He's the author of The Decision to Use the Atomic Bomb. He says, new research into Japanese decision-making now suggests that the atomic bomb played only a secondary role in Japan's surrender. Studies by Toshushi Hasegawa and Pulitzer Prize winner Herbert Blix tie in with the long-established evidence suggesting that months before the bombings, top American and British policymakers were aware that a declaration of war by the Soviet Union combined with assurances for the Japanese Empire would likely end the war. However, they preferred to use the atomic bomb for political reasons. Most American military leaders criticized the bombing publicly after the war, including General Dwight D. Eisenhower, President Truman's Chief of Staff, Admiral William Leahy, and even the well-known hawk, General Curtis LeMay. Also, the head of submarine warfare, as I said last week, said there was no need to invade the island. The island was isolated from everything it needed, and it could be quarantined. The U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey said that Japan would have surrendered on its own by no later than November, and that no attack was necessary. About 100 Detroiters went down to what was the largest peace demonstration ever held in East Tennessee yesterday. 100 Michigan residents traveled to Oak Ridge, Tennessee for the August 6th commemoration of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This is the 60th anniversary year. And they're part of a nonviolent protest against the United States' continued production of nuclear weapons. The protest in Tennessee, I'm reading from their news release here, is part of a national action by thousands of people who went to at least four U.S. facilities where work on nuclear weapons is ongoing. What's there in East Tennessee in Oak Ridge is called the Y-12 National Security Complex in Oak Ridge, and it continues to refurbish and upgrade nuclear warheads so they will last 100 to 120 years. Now, what's this for? Who are we fighting? We spend $500 billion a year on armaments. China, you say, well, what about those Chinese? They spent about $50 billion. And I forgot, I don't know if this says in here, how many, I saw this somewhere, how many nuclear weapons that they have. Not very many. Not like the 6,000 that we have. You say, well, you always want to keep the edge. I think a much safer way, don't you think, would be to start negotiating treaties where they were all eliminated. But instead, the madmen in the White House want to continue this Are we going to ever get out of this without another one being dropped? Are we ever going to get out of this without a terrorist gaining access to what we brought into the world? I sure hope so. They have a building that Bush has designated for, what do they call this, Life Extension Stockpile Stewardship Program. Clear violation, by the way, of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And they want to, their plans to build a new nuclear weapons and a new facility for it that'll cost $1 billion. That's what it's going to cost us. All right. That said, 313-298-WRIF. You want to email calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. All right, want to get to your calls. A few of you are waiting already. There's a couple open lines. You can grab those. 313-298-WRIF. Here's a headline. It says, Bush endorses teaching intelligent design theory in schools. Now, intelligent design is the belief that life forms are so complex that their creation can't be explained by Darwin's theory of evolution. But it points, by implication at least, to intentional creation, perhaps divine, presumably divine. This is sort of a backdoor way of getting religious teaching, into secular public schools, schools that are designated as secular. They have religious schools, and then they've got these other things called churches, where they can teach all this stuff every Sunday after school, wherever. So this is set up. And when you start introducing religion into the public sphere, should I point you to other countries where you see the kind of strife that occurs when religions start either trying to dominate sections of the population that are different than theirs, have different religious beliefs, and sometimes it actually even flares into open warfare? We don't need this. That's one of the, there's lots of reasons for keeping this society secular like it was set up. But here, Bush waded into the debate over evolution and intelligent design last Monday, saying schools should teach both theories on the creation and complexity of life. What's wrong with that statement? He said schools should teach both theories on the creation and complexity of life. Intelligent design is not a theory in the sense that science means it. Theories have theorems. They can be tested. They have development over the decades, or in some cases of, like Darwin, over 100 years or so. The proposition, the religious proposition, the spiritual proposition, which properly belongs in religious institutions, is based on, I don't know what. I mean, sort of, what do they call it? Inductive reasoning. Deductive means you start seeing phenomena and you connect it up and you wind up with a theory. If there's theories of physics, doesn't mean they're untested. It means they are tested and it's accepted. Evolution is the basis of biological science. With intelligent design or creationism and a dollar, you can get on the bus. I mean, it might make you support your religious beliefs, and if it does, fine. But keep it out of our schools. Because to some extent, if you think about it, where most Americans, unlike me, most Americans profess a belief in God, that means that they believe in, intelligent design to begin with. God kind of said, at some point, made the world. Nothing to do today. There you go. And since he's omniscient, right? He's all-seeing. He knew everything that was going to happen. Had to. I'm getting into my argumentation about belief. Never mind. I won't go there. We'll stick with intelligent design. For one thing, this is intelligent design? Look at this world. This is intelligent design? It's funny. I have the opposite view. Whenever I see complexities of the natural world, I think that reinforces my view that there is no intelligent design. Or why in the world would a God bother to put all this stuff together? I mean, I suppose if there is a God and he's omnipotent, all-powerful, he would do anything. Let's create weird fishes at the bottom of the sea. No one will ever see them other than the other weird fishes at the bottom of the sea, but so what? That's what I want to do on Tuesday. And then all the little birds, for instance, that are up around, sort of in the Arctic Circle, and all these warblers and everything, and then we go, let's see, we'll send the magnolia warbler, the magnolia warbler, we'll send it to where he's not, we, I, me, big I, big capital M. I'm going to send him to Guatemala during the winter, and then I'm going to have him fly back. And how about, I don't know, a pine warbler? We'll send him and her to Mexico. I mean, see, it doesn't make a bit of sense. And the inductive, the opposite of deductive reasoning, where you see a bunch of phenomena, you connect it up, you test theories, and then you make assumptions from there. And it's operational, and there's proofs, then it becomes a theory within science. If you go inductively, like you say, there is a God, and then... Hence, I believe that, so there must be some intelligent design to all this, or it couldn't be so complex. Again, you're welcome to hold that opinion. It makes no difference to me. But when it starts being inserted into public life, I think that endangers the body politic. Because the people that are doing this aren't the liberal Christians. And I don't know if other religions are doing it. Aren't the liberal Christians. They're... And you can, if you go beneath all of this, you'll see who they are. Isn't there some little group here? What's it called? Oh, the National Council on Bible Curriculum in Public Schools. And they say that documented research through NASA backs the biblical account of the sun standing still. They say that the Constitution is based on the scriptures. Again, they're more than welcome to their opinion. They can hold whatever beliefs they want. I don't care. But what we want is a society that is neutral, where decisions are made on the best science and in the best sense that when we're making decisions, we're making it for everybody. But what I was saying is this is not the liberal Christians that are trying to insert all this stuff, but it's the right-wing Christians. It's right-wingers using Christianity for their political agenda. To stop a woman's right to choose, for instance. I mean, they want to capture society for their views. I don't think that's good. They've got their churches. They've got their whatevers. They even got their schools. So keep them out of ours. That's what I say. I'd like to hear your opinion. I'm Peter Werbe, and our number is 313-298-WRIF. Email is calltalkyes@yahoo.com. If you'd like to see my website where you can get more of what I'm saying, if this isn't enough, peterwerbe.com, peterwerbe.com. Let's see. Let's do this. Jay Hudson, our producer and phone screener. Let me get Chris here because he's calling from kind of far away. Chris is calling from Flint. Chris, hi. You're on the air. Welcome. Hey, turn it off!
He's calling.
Turn it off!
He's calling from Flint.
Hey, Chris.
Hello.
Hey, turn your radio off.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. Go ahead.
I just had a kind of a 2 cents on this one. If America seems to be programmed by television, and that's literally what we do for a pastime. And by watching television all the time, we are literally programmed by television.
Okay.
Another comment along that line would be the fact of one of the movies that makes that really hit note to me would be Good Morning Vietnam with Robin Williams.
That's a great movie, yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, I was doing what I was in. Good Morning Vietnam, yeah.
Well, he ran to the teletype to get the latest news. So he would rip that off and go back, and he'd say, well, I'm going to read this, and that. Well, the government would say, no, they'd scratch off this, and you can read this, because we, the government, will allow you to do that.
Yeah.
And literally programmed, again, by the government. The parents, per se, are telling you what you are going to know and are not going to know.
Well, let me ask you this, Chris. Do you watch much television?
Literally, no. I don't. I'm away from home too much. But what television I have watched, it just that seems to be everybody's pastime.
Yeah, Yeah, it is now popular culture. It has substituted for all sorts of forms where people came more in contact with another outside of the home, or people entertain themselves. And now it's we just sit and. I mean, sometimes I walk my dog at night, and just every house, there it is, glowing.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And that's what everybody does is watch television, and that's where all of the information that is passed out to the American public is coming from. And so, therefore, literally could be a brainwash to American society. So, you know, they could put on whatever they wanted each night, day after day after day, and the American public is programmed to believe that. And, you know, if you see it long enough, hear it long enough, see it, and you become to believe it.
Well, sure. You remember in 1984 in George Orwell's novel, the slogan was, Big Brother is watching you. And so we had this authoritarian government, or in the novel, the authoritarian government was watching all the citizens to make sure that they didn't step out of line. And Mark Crispin Miller, in his book Boxed In, about watching television, which is excellent, his last chapter is Big Brother is you watching. So what we do is we, rather than the rulers watching us, we watch the rulers' material and get all of our cues of what to think and how to dress and how to smell and what medicines to wear. Now, it may sound to some people who just find it a pleasant form of entertainment that I'm making it a little bit too sinister. But ultimately, it does exactly as you're saying, Chris. It shapes our consciousness, even if we think we can resist it. And I've said 100 times that I watch nothing on there, including all the talk and information and Sunday morning shows. If I thought there was anything of substance there for me to do this show, and I have to know at least somewhat of what I'm talking about, I'd watch it all the time. Every once in a while, I watch the nightly news to figure what stories are playing big and how are they playing them. Other than that, I'd say they're almost worthless as information. And also I've said that I think what television is good for and what I use it for is mindless entertainment, sports, some movies, stuff like that. And that's good. I mean, I don't always want to be steeped in serious stuff. Chris, thanks for calling from Flint. I appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Rob in White Lake. Rob, hi. It's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. How's it going?
Going great. Thanks.
Well, I was just hearing you talking about intelligent design, and I've certainly looked at a lot of stuff on this, and I don't know, something I've just noticed about religion creeping into academia in general, it's people don't seem to understand the idea of why they teach different things anymore. People seem to be off. I've noticed that some of the religious people in some social science type classes believe that they're being kept from expressing their view just because they can't write something on opinion, because they can't back it up with research. And intelligent design seems to be falling along this same line. They just think that it's the opposite of evolution, so it should be taught, regardless of the fact that it isn't helpful as a real theory in the scientific sense. There's no... It doesn't really teach science at all.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I hate to use the same little cliche in the same program so close together, but with intelligent design or creationism in a dollar, you can get on the bus. That, as I said, is that evolutionary theory is the basis of the biological sciences, and that you can do stuff with that. I don't know. What is that? And all you got to do is get your kids to go to church. See, a lot of kids, you know, much less people go to church than actually than say they do when they respond in these polls. So if you want your kids to learn intelligent design or creationism, all you got to do is take church every Sunday, and old Reverend Brown will tell them that. And either he'll say it's complementary to evolution if he's kind of, what would you say, modern. And if he's a fundamentalist, he'll say, no, it's all wrong, it's all BS, and it all started like 4,000 years ago, and God put the fossils there along with Adam and Eve. But whatever, that's your choice. You're a free American. You can send your kids to an institution where they say all intelligence came from the Plutonian space fleet, and good. But when we want people to enter our medical system and other parts of biological research, could they please be up on the latest of what constitutes scientific theory and not religious theory?
But yes, that's just it. People say things like, information is just a theory. They think just a theory is the same thing as just somebody's idea they came up with. They don't understand that there's actually quite a bit of data that people have collected, and this has been refined over the years.
Well, it's stronger than that. I mean, it's a theory is the theory of evolution, like the other scientific theories aren't. It's not like, you know, like, again, it's not like I have a theory that we were visited by space invaders.
That's a quasi-theory.
That's not even a quasi. It's not a theory. It's based on nothing. It's not even a hypothesis. I mean, remember that stuff from high school biology? You have a working hypothesis because something has been observed empirically. And from there, you can make assumptions. You can test the hypothesis. And when a number of hypotheses come together, you can create an operational theory. What happens from, I kind of keep looking for this word. It just seems to keep going out of my mind, intelligent design. And as I said, this is intelligent design. All right, I got to go. Thanks.
Okay.
Appreciate it. All right, we'll be right back. See you.
CE spells fast, easy auto insurance.
Quote, buy, print, instantly at Esurance. Get your quote from esurance.com today.
La, 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 la.
On Demand from Comcast Digital Cable is not only an amazing library of hit movies, classic sitcoms, cartoons, and cable shows that you control.
La, 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 la.
It's also great on-demand programs that can help you learn.
La, 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 la.
Like how to become a better cook, a better gardener, to get in better shape, not to mention voice training.
La, 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 la.
To become a great singer. And because On Demand from Comcast Digital Cable is under your control, you can play, rewind, stop, fast forward, or pause so you can, well, learn at your own pace. Call 1-888-COMCAST to get Comcast Digital Cable with free on-demand and HBO. All for just $39.99 per month for 6 months. Pick a show, watch it whenever. Now TV waits for you. New customers only. After promotional period, regular charges apply. Installation, taxes, and franchise fees not included. On-demand programs are limited and some are subject to charge. Other restrictions apply. Limited time offer.
101 WRIF and Rite Aid want you to see it all from the front row. The Woodward Cruise returns to rev up the Motor City on Saturday, August 20th. From Ferndale to Pontiac, you could be one of millions checking out the hottest classic cars the Motor City has ever turned out. And you could be seeing it all up close and personal. Picture yourself at the front row for the Woodward Cruise. All you need to do is stop in your neighborhood Rite Aid for details on how to win. You could even get your own classic car for the weekend to drive around town and join in on all the cruise action. Plus, you and nine of your friends will be sitting in the front row for the Woodward Cruise at Batteries Plus between 13 and 14 miles. Throw in 10 Rite Aid director's chairs, 10 lunch-size coolers filled with food and beverages, and 10 disposable cameras, and you're viewing the cruise in style on August 20th. Just head to your neighborhood Rite Aid today. It's that easy. Get ready to see it all from the front row. The Woodward Cruise, August 20th from Rite Aid and 101 WRIF.
Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix, the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-824-6692. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. Call now for a brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more. 1-800-824-6692. Programs vary by campus. Call University of Phoenix now. 1-800-824-6692. That's 1-800-824-6692.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back. We're talking about, how does this guy do this? Bush endorsing teaching intelligent design. This is this theory that says that Darwin's evolutionary theory doesn't alone explain all the complexity of creation. So it has to, how do you teach intelligent design? Creationism essentially just says, which is the outright Christian explanation that these religious violators of the Constitution want to shove into our schools. But intelligent design, what would you say? Well, you know, there had to be something a little more than theory. Intelligent design must have been the hand of God. Okay, that's it. All right, thanks. Appreciate that. Let's get on to the enormous body of scientific information about evolutionary science. But your thoughts on it, 313-298-WRIF. If you'd like to, I haven't even looked at the email tonight. Call talkyes at yahoo.com. Somebody called up and says, who is this? Called up Jay Hudson, our producer and phone screener, said, who is this left-wing weirdo on the air? Well, it's me. Hey, it's me. I've been doing this for a long time. And yet some people just sort of miss that this happens at they only come out at night, right? Wasn't that an old Alice Cooper album? And if you want to get an idea of who I am and what I think beyond this, besides going to my website, you can pick up the current issue of the tabloid The Record. It's Detroit's Music Journal, the August edition. It's sixth issue, has an interview with me. Almost forgot about it. This interview that was done by Mike McHone. I'm looking at myself, this photograph of me, and I got a sweater on. Man, I thought winter coming. Just too much. Mike Mahone, thank you very much. If you're listening, you say in your introduction that you listen a lot. And I was so taken with your introduction. You could probably, when I kick off, you could almost use this as my obituary. I mean, it's not written like that, but it's just a very, very nice statement by someone who's listened for a long time. I really appreciate it. So it's The Record, Detroit's music I got to remember, what's our little journal, right? Detroit's Music Journal. It's a free paper, and it's around town. So you'll find out who this left-wing weirdo is. All right, let us go back to our phones, and we'll grab Chris from Harrison Township. Chris, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? Long-time listener.
Well, thank you.
Hey, you know, I'm 21 years old, and, you know, I got to say, for what you were talking about, it's kind of funny. If you think back to the times of our forefathers, when we first started this country, weren't we trying to keep for probably the 251 years that we've been a country, religion and government and schools and church separate from each other?
I thought that was the idea.
Right, because, you know, if you look back in the history of times, even before when Britain was ruling us, we always had religion with the government, and you found that it never works in society. It's because, you know, you try to drill one realistic idea into people's heads, and it never works. You create civil wars. You create, you know, all kinds of catastrophe. Like, look what happens in the Middle East.
Sure.
What do they fight? It's a constant religion war over there. They don't know any other war but that over there. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, we're over there trying to, you know, fight them, and, you know, we're fighting three wars. Not only, you know, they're fighting three wars. They're fighting each other. They're fighting us, and, you know, we're trying to fight them. So, you know, it's a lose-lose situation.
Well, I know. Why doesn't that occur to them? I mean, the history of the West in Europe and in, particularly in Europe is so, as you're saying, is so replete with examples. And then you go around the world, and when you talk about, they always say, one nation under God, I always think of Iran. or something like that. Some country that the political structure, one of the ways it dominates people is through enforcing their religious beliefs on everyone, and or Saudi Arabia. And if you violate that, man, they take you away. It's a crime. It's a crime to believe, not only to not believe, it's a crime to believe differently than the official religion.
Well, right, and, you know, Bush talks, you know, tolerance of other people's religions. Well, tolerance of other people's religions is not cramming yours down the throat of everybody else and making you, you know, believe one religion. It's accepting everybody's religions for what they are. We all try to get along the best we can.
Yeah, I mean, do you care what religion or lack of it anyone else has? I don't.
No, I mean, I'm a Christian myself, and my religion teaches tolerance and do not judge people based on their religion or whatever. It's up to our God to decide that, you know, and I don't really care. You know, I don't look at race, color, creed, or religion as a factor when I meet a person. I care about what the person is. You know, I don't have to believe what you don't believe. In the end, we'll all find out who's right and wrong anyways.
Well, there you go. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, I was wondering, he says, in the end, we'll all find out, huh, if you're a non-believer like me, what will you discover? What is there something at the end of the road you will meet your God? Have you ever seen those things? And I wonder if a God is loving, would he judge someone like myself harshly? Of course, you folks only know my radio presence. You don't know what I do in my daily life. Maybe I'm just mean and ornery and have stolen and hurt people and vicious and all sorts of stuff like that. He may just have to take me at my word that I think I've been a pretty good person throughout my life and kind and loving and generous to the people around me. Again, you might have to ask them if they all agree. I hope, and I guess I think, that they would say that. So if I carry out, like, 7 of the commandments, like the first 3, which is just pretty much the adulation of the God figure, but the other 7, even though, remember, I've played that George Carlin, 10 Commandments, you could really get it down to just a couple. But in any event, I pretty much, you know, I haven't murdered anybody. I don't lie about people. What are the rest of them? Don't steal. Covet thy neighbor's wife. Are there one? Oh, no. But yeah. Can't you sin in your mind the way, what was it, Jimmy Carter said he had sinned in his mind? Can't you? Never mind. I don't want to go there about my neighbor's wife. Anyways, you would think a merciful God would say, oh, this jerk wasn't smart enough to figure out that I was really there, and I'm real, and so, you know, I'm not going to send him down to hell. I'm going to take him at my side. But if he is a punitive God, the way these right-wing Christians think, gone. Anyways, I wouldn't want to be. I mean, can you imagine those people actually going to a heaven if it's defined the way we say, you know, they say it is? Remember, anyways, Mark Twain's dictum, heaven for the climate, hell for the company. So where are your pals going to be? All right, if you're ringing, hold on. Our phone screener, Jay Hudson, will grab it at 313-298-WRIF. Let's see here. If I can get my little machine to work here. Yeah, there you go. Here is Martin. Martin's listening in Detroit. Thanks for calling, Martin. Hi.
Hi. Great show, great topic. Watt and I observed the teaching of evolution in public school and elsewhere, and I see a lot of references to what might be thought of as an oxymoron, because I think in opposing intelligent design, you're favoring the idea of natural selection, but you're saying that this natural selection occurs without a mind directing it. And in information theory, I think it's well usually thought that you can't get information from non-information.
Yeah.
So that if the DNA, which is a pretty extravagant list of instructions for the construction of a living thing, the DNA would be information. It had to come from somewhere.
Okay.
So I think that's probably, by the way, and what it is, it's an alternative explanation to what's being posed as a, you know, the evolutionary theory. Now, I'm more of into physical science rather than life science, so I'm not at the top of my game in dealing with evolution. But in terms of the motivation of the supporters, I think that we can undermine them with a better knowledge of their own book. Yeah, I think I've talked to you about this before.
Their own book being the Bible?
Yes, okay. Because their own book doesn't allow them to live off the underpaid work of other people. It condemns the abuse of smaller nations by larger nations. The whole chapter in a very obscure biblical book called Habakkuk that talks about that. So, and by the way, a loving God. What would a loving God do with Peter Wibby or with Martin? A merciful God. Do you know what a merciful God did?
What?
Christians say that a loving God sent part of the deity to earth to take the punishment for our sins. That's pretty darn merciful, I think.
Well, there's an assumption there that I don't share, and one of the reasons I don't like the story, that there's some innate base nature to humans rather than a basically... Well, it's the old Christianity versus existentialism. I mean, I hope I'm not going, but folks, stay with me. This is going to be easily understood. And does essence precede existence, or does existence precede essence? In other words, are you born with a certain nature that is sinful, or are you born blank, and then one begins to define through the ethical choices you make throughout life what kind of person you are? I go for the latter. The Christian, the Judeo-Christian model is the former. That is to say that there is an inherent essence, which I don't believe.
The Christian model gets confused because of freedom of religion and freedom of thought. We get a whole cacophony of voices, including... catchphrases that are used, for example, talking about the tendency of man to be total depravity in Calvinism, for example, is a phrase that gets thrown around a lot. And even Calvinists would say that we are not, our nature is to be evil, but we are not all as evil as we could be.
Well,
so you have nice people.
Well, you do have Hitlers and Stalins.
Yeah,
so
exactly. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, some of my sins are kind of far below that. All right. Thank you.
Sure.
Appreciate your call. Thanks for calling in. 313-298-WRIF. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. By the way, this program is rebroadcast tomorrow at 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on radiopower.org. Radiopower.org. It's archived almost immediately at whiterosesociety.org. So I'm not trying to get anybody to go to bed, but it's available in, beyond this. But stay with the live excitement. Let's go down to Monroe, Michigan, the home of General George Custer and Fermi II, and talk to Jeremiah. Hi, Jeremiah. It's Peter Werby.
How's it going, Pete?
Going great.
I wanted to go back a little bit. I was in my car coming home, and I heard you talking about the Hiroshima, the anniversary, and the how people were getting upset over that. I just wanted to share something. Last night I was in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and people were... They draw little outlines on the pavement, of people being, flash burned and stuff
right.
like that. And I just want to share some information about the whole thing. A little bit about myself. I got back from Iraq in March. I was with the, ironically enough, the 7th Cavalry. And my father was in World War II, and he was in the Philippines, and he went to the occupation of Japan. And he was one of the few people who went to Hiroshima about a week to 2 weeks after the bombing, and he said he doesn't want to talk about it, but
right.
what he told me was that they hadn't buried the bodies yet. Now, he also got to peruse their defenses, the stuff they had built up, and they were ready for, his invasion. And he said that they had, tanks buried up to the turrets and all the approaches on the beaches. They had sluices, like metal sluices filled with midget man subs, or basically a torpedo with two guys strapped to it. Kamikaze planes everywhere, mountains hollowed out with train tracks running back and forth with loopholes, and on these trains were, heavy artillery guns. They could just go back and forth, and he basically thought it would be suicide to try and invade Japan. And, so I grew up, hearing that, nuke them. It was the thing, go ahead. He was thankful because he survived. And I can understand a lot of those people. Nuclear weapons are not fun, and I saw some stuff in Iraq that was much smaller scale than that, and it was not fun. So I can understand their position. But if you look at it from the perspective of the Japanese themselves, I see them, on TV doing their offerings and, praying for their dead and stuff like that. And, I'm like, wow, that's terrible. All those people got blown up. But there's a couple of things that you have to look at. Like, first of all, when are they going to do a memorial for all the other people they killed? Number one.
Yeah, they're always the charge. Whoa,
yeah.
I mean,
that's the one thing the Chinese.
Yeah, that the Chinese are so put out about. I mean, the Japanese armies were extraordinarily vicious to the point where it was almost psychotic what they did to the people whose lands they invaded in China and the Philippines. I mean, they posed themselves as the liberators of these countries from Western domination, and they were correct. I mean, there was this horrible exploitative system, particularly the European powers, but also including the United States, that had dominated East Asia. But rather than saying, "Gee, well, we're here, we are, you're liberators," they did, you know, they half the time what they did was called the rape. I mean, like the Rape of Nanking.
Yeah, and that's an excellent book by Iris Chang, by the way.
Yes, it is. You're correct. Really downplayed.
But here's
in
one
Japan.
Thing that most people, here's the point I wanted to bring up, the less sexy, I guess you could say, aspect of that is that people like they were saying that certain high-level people in the American government were disgusted at the nuclear bomb, and I don't blame them. I mean, you see a city flattened, it's going to be disgusting. But the other thing is, well, the embargo or the bombing or the Russian intervention, these things would have brought Japan to their knees. I agree, they fully would have, but the cost is one of the things we were doing. Is we were firebombing cities on a regular basis, like clockwork,
mm-hmm.
which were killing far more people. More people died in Tokyo than did in Hiroshima. I guarantee that. We're bombing the rail lines. And the problem, I don't know if you know much about the geography of Japan, but the whole Kyoto, Edo, Tokyo corridor there,
right.
The central, that's where there were several, I think, I don't want to guess the number of millions, but there were millions upon millions of Japanese there, and that's where the rail lines all came together because they had, you know, that's the way the geography of Japan is. The central administration is going to have the most rail lines, and that was where all the food distribution centers were. And if you bombed those rail lines, those people would have starved, and you couldn't have rebuilt them in time. So if we'd waited till November of 45 and let them surrender, those 20 million people would have all died, no matter what we could have done.
Well, I got to tell you that I have heard from time to time, Jeremiah, this situation that in some way that the bombing, the atomic bombing of Japan was almost humanitarian, because it was less deaths than would have occurred if there would have been an invasion, or, as you said, if other scenarios would have occurred. I don't know. That's all hypothetical. I think what really has to be looked at is the reasoning. Was it military or political? And I say that it was almost overwhelmingly political and militarily unnecessary. And I guess I have people like Eisenhower and LeMay and Lehi, I can't remember his name. Anyways, the naval guy that backs that up. I don't know.
You have to take that into account, though, that, you know, like Clausewitz said, war is just politics by other means. So
yeah.
to say it's politically motivated, well, the whole war was politically motivated. If we didn't care, you know,
sure.
What they do. You know,
well,
we would have just let Hitler.
But what I'm getting at is the generals thought there was no military necessity for bombing those cities. It was solely the cabinet around Bush. The scientists didn't want to do it. People like Einstein said that they could have wanted there to be a non-military display of it for the Japanese to see what kind of awesome weapon they had. But the United States, and you can see this in some of the papers of it, they wanted the world to know, and particularly the Soviets, that not only did we have this incredibly destructive weapon, but we were willing to use it on other people.
That's true. I mean, also, the converse, you could ask that question, well, if we had done the demonstration, do you think the Japanese would have called our bluff and said, you're not going to use it?
Well, I think what would have happened if the Soviets would have declared war on whenever it was supposed to be, like the 10th of August, and they would have said, we'll allow the institution of the emperor to remain, they probably would have surrendered to the Soviets. And that was one of the things that the bombing was done to forestall.
Yeah, and can you imagine a Japan split in half like Korea? Well, that would have been, the Cold War would have been much worse.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, Jeremiah. It was such a horror show on every regard, and most of the choices were horrible. But one of the things, one of the demonstrations that was there for all is the destructive power of that, and the genie's out of the bottle, and what this government ought to be about, as should all governments, is how can we reduce and then finally eliminate with real assuredness that these weapons will not exist anymore, like polio or something like that. Okay. I got a roll on, so thank you for your thoughts. I appreciate that. I'm glad you got back from Iraq in good shape. Let's see. What time do we have? All right. We got to do these. Got to get these in before midnight. Give me a call. 313-298-WRIF. I'll be right back.
To schedule a consultation.
Put your best face and body forward. Dr. Gregory Roche.
Get there, get
care. Oh, hello to you. It is Uri. Every year, we have the running of the bears. We set the bears loose, and the mass have to run to the bar at the far end of the village for a refreshing smear of ice. It's perfectly safe. There are plenty of slower runners than me.
Smirnoff Ice. Brr. Please drink responsibly. Copyright 2005, the Smirnoff Company, Norwalk, Connecticut. Smirnoff Ice, premium malt beverage made in the USA.
Get.
Hello, guys. It is Uri. Whenever I go to a party, I always invite at least one person who isn't drinking. They may not join in with the singing, dancing, and playing Pass the Weasel, but they make excellent designated drivers. Another glass of yak's milk, Kremler? Smirnoff Ice. Please drink responsibly.
Copyright 2005 by the Smirnoff Company, Norwalk, Connecticut. Smirnoff Ice, premium malt beverage made in the USA.
So what's going on in the house that Rock built, David?
Whoa, excuse me?
What's happening at Rock Financial?
Oh, the newest, the latest and greatest. I got a doozy for you.
Real? A doozy?
I love the word doozy.
Okay, Beaver Cleaver.
Quick and easy. No pay stubs, no W-2s, no tax returns. A lot of folks have asked me about this. It's not a new one. It's an oldie but a goodie. Here's the deal. If you maybe are paid on commission, you're self-employed, you're in between jobs, there are so many factors of why you would want to use the Quick and Easy loan. And the interest rate on our Quick and Easy loan is extremely close to market rates. It's not 2 or 3% higher. We're talking right there. Right there.
So you don't slam the door on people just because they aren't conventional.
Thank you. That's exactly what I was trying to say.
Help everybody?
She could have done it in 5 seconds. It took me 60.
Well, you can call the Rock Financial experts and they'll fill in the rest.
Right.
800-333-ROCK. They're home of the mortgage experts and you can visit them online at rockfinancial.com. Rock Financial, the Quicken Loans Company, Equal Housing Lender. Call today, 800-333-ROCK.
It's a doozy, the Quick and Easy. It's
doozy.
A doozy.
You doozy.
Doozy.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome back. We're doing this for one more hour. And, you know, I should have been saying this right from the beginning. I have one of the, I did, and yeah, it's not me. This is my guess. I'm not blowing my own horn. I guess if you're in showbiz, you can blow your own horn. But I'm not. I have an interview ready to roll at 1 a.m. with Professor, I got to remember this all. What is his name? Ronald Siegel. Right. He is a psychopharmacologist. He teaches at the University of California Medical School. And he has a book called Intoxication, The Universal Drive for Mind-Altering Substances. Wow. Sounds like Bob Dylan's Everybody Must Get Stoned, but it is amazing what this guy has to say. In fact, I meant to bring the book and read from it. Maybe I'll do it next week, because he has some challenges. Remember I was saying, if you heard me earlier, about you got to always be ready to have a bit of doubt in your beliefs and be willing to change. So he has some interesting thoughts about legalization of drugs. Like, I'm completely libertarian on it. Legalize them all, even the awful stuff. and give our citizenry the information that they need for people that can't, like any medical situation, that people get themselves into a medical jam. We got to take care of them because there are fellow citizens, our family and friends and what have you, and just making them terrible criminals is stupid. And as Professor Siegel says, is never, never, ever going to be won. No war on drugs has ever been won anywhere. All right, 313-298-WRIF, calltalkass@yahoo.com. We're still swirling around with the decision to drop the bomb on Hiroshima, but also with Bush's call for teaching intelligent design in schools. I say it has no business being in public schools, and that bringing religion into the public sphere historically has always had awful results. As all we have to do is look around the world. Look around the world today. I mean, even people that are of the same religion, the same general religion, Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland, Shiites and Sunnis in Iraq. Not good. Bruce writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Just a friendly reminder about the chat room during your show. I didn't mention it. That's right. You can go to tomhartman.com, tomhartman.com, and piggyback on Tom's chat room during this program. They always want new people. I don't think they got a whole lot, maybe because it's not my chat room, but you're welcome there, and people are there to discuss it. Also, you find out about Tom Hartman's shows, who's a friend of mine and really a swell broadcaster. I already got that one read. Let's see, I had a couple others here. Laura writes in, oh no, I'm sorry, it's not Laura, it's John. John writes in on Laura's email. Good program as usual. I love you, Pete, but you're wrong on this one. Please see The Face That Demonstrates the Farce of Evolution by Hank Hanegraaff. Yes, he's a Christian, but that's not why I reference him. I would challenge you to check out his scientific data and give whatever credence you want to the spiritual part. Remember, how about an interview with one of the Doors? I've done interviews with John Densmore, the drummer, who has tinnitus and can't drum anymore, you know, ringing in your ears. And also with, why can't I think of the other, Manzarek. What's his first name? I'm losing it. Anyways, the keyboard player. Hey, or Dylan. How am I going to interview Dylan? He's not going to interview. He doesn't do interviews with hardly anybody unless you're writing a book on him. But there's tons of books out debunking evolution. It's not, that's not real impressive. You can go find and say, you know, it's just totally wrong. Let me see. What? Brzezinski says, I'm in the doghouse tonight, so I thought I'd email you. Intelligent design would be all right if they included every possible way we came about. Well, that there are many authors like Zach Stitchin who have looked at civilization long before the Bible. And, you know, and there are people. Remember I was saying earlier about maybe that the reason this all happened was because of the intervention of the Plutonian space fleet? And there are people that claim that it was extraterrestrial intervention that created human intelligence, is that human beings never would have evolved beyond the state that they were, that they reject the development of species and say that species are static, and that the humanoids, pre-human as we know us, figures, only were able to develop intelligence through the intervention of space aliens. Should we teach that? There's some people that believe it. All right. Where's my... I've got to pull up another screen here, and we will look and see... I'm doing this now, who has been waiting the longest. Here's Brian in Rochester Hills. Brian, thanks for your patience. It's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Thanks, Peter. Great show, first of all, but I really have to challenge you on some of the things you've been saying here.
Go ahead, sure.
First, let's just shoot just real quick on the evolution thing. Evolutionists believe in what's called macroevolution. There's two types of evolution, micro and macro. Micro, just very briefly, takes place at a micro level, and that is due to genetic mutation. So
right.
There is things change at micro levels all the time, and any creationist who has any sort of scientific background will acknowledge the fact that there is microevolution. That goes unargued. But it's macroevolution, which is up for debate. And that is the idea that, a lizard turned into a bird that turned into whatever, okay. You name whatever came from what, we came from an ape.
Right.
And the basic thought of evolution is that you give us millions and millions of years, and we can have changes that take place. And the reason that we don't see the things today is because it takes millions and millions of years. My big problem with that is there is no transitional fossils that show the evolutionary record to be true. If it took millions and millions, and I guess it depends on which scientist you talk to and how long it took, because every one of them has a different idea. But if you look at any evolutionist, they say, give me a long, long time, and through random chance and time, I can have evolution take place, and one thing can turn to the next. And the problem with that is there is just no transitional fossils. If there was millions and millions of years of evolution to take place, we would have more transitional fossils than we do of, let's say, the normal fossils, and that's just not there.
Well, I don't think that's really the question, because there are missing gaps in evolutionary theory. I mean, I think anybody, the most atheistic evolutionist scientist would say that. I think what's at root here is how do we, in what sphere do we communicate science, and what sphere do we communicate religious ideas? And I say that in a secular society, because that's what occurs to me works best, we challenge and debate scientific areas in the public sphere and in public institutions, and religious considerations are elsewhere in their own venue.
Well, on a second note, and going along with that, you're talking about the idea of right and wrong almost is what you're kind of looking at, and where you go for your right and wrong. So I guess I would ask the question, where do you go to determine what's right and what's wrong from a moral and philosophical aspect?
Me personally?
Or anybody. Where is the place
okay.
to go?
Well, in other words, the old kind of, what would you say, the contention is, if God is dead, all is permissible. In other words, if there's no moral or ethical root, there's no ethical absolute, then anything is permissible, right? So how do you ground your ethics? Well, every religion and everything everywhere says it's a golden rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I know that if I commit small or large crimes, that, in fact, in existentialism, which is atheistic in its basic belief, it says that every choice you make has a universal nature to it. So if you choose cruelty, then cruelty becomes universalized. If you choose dishonesty, then that becomes universalized. And certainly, as anybody would say, people professing Christianity have carried out the most heinous crimes and brutal undertakings that you would almost think God is dead.
Oh, I totally agree with you, but I guess the problem is, if I think there's been a generalization, at least in people that I run into, that we go to ourselves to find out what's right and what's wrong, and what's wrong, and whatever I feel is right for me, and if it's not right for you, then leave me alone. And I have a real problem with that, because that, by definition, is kind of anarchy, as you mentioned. You know, if a guy is starving and needs to feed his kids, and he's just lost his job and has no money, and he comes up and grabs your wallet, you have no reason, if he really feels true in his heart that he's right because he's got kids to feed, to tell him that he's wrong and stealing your wallet. So you have to find a fundamental truth to go for right and wrong. You can't just go by what you feel, because everybody's feelings are different. Would you agree with that?
Well, yeah, I agree with that. And societies, including anarchist societies, which are pretty much the way all the pre-technological, pre-state societies run, understand that if they want to have a smooth functioning society without destructive competition, that there has to be respect, cooperation, particularly. And when societies begin to lose that, they become, they become less and less good places to live. All right, thank you so much. I appreciate it, Brian. Where did I see this? This was funny. This is the headline: fewer Americans think Bush is honest. This is very incredible. Less than half of Americans now say they think President Bush is honest, according to an AP poll taken at the time of increasing concerns about Iraq. The percentage of people who say they consider Bush honest has dropped slightly from the start of the year. At the start of the year, 53% described him as honest, while now people are about evenly split. 50% say he's not honest. 48% say he's honest. Solid majority see Bush as likable and a strong leader. His overall job approval was 42%. 55% of us disapprove. His approval of handling Iraq was 38%. That's way down there. But so they don't think he's honest. The majority of people don't think he's honest. The vast majority of people say he screwed up in Iraq. I had one other thing here. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was at the bottom of this pile. Isn't it? Yeah. One-third of 32% of us say the United States can't win the war. Another 21% say the United States could win the war, but don't think we will. So that's 53%. 58% of us say the United States will not be able to establish a stable democratic government in Iraq. And for the first time, a majority of Americans, 51%, this is USA Today poll, say the Bush administration deliberately misled the public about whether Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. So it wasn't a mistake that it was a lie, that he deliberately misled the American public. But then he said 53% say it wasn't a mistake to go into the war. Does this make any sense? It doesn't to me. Well, we got to get this call because it's long distance. It's from Atlanta, Georgia. It is Steve. Steve, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. I appreciate you thinking of my phone bill. That's really nice of you.
Sure.
You were talking about the dropping of the atomic bombs. I wanted to make the point that the bombing of Dresden, the city of Dresden, Germany, during World War II is actually, I believe, February 13th and 14th, 1945.
Mm-hmm.
Far, far worse, of
sure.
Far more horrible, a singular event than either one, or even those two cities combined. Not excusing that, but you hardly ever see any movies made of this, Hollywood films. It's horrible what we did. Dresden had no military targets whatsoever. It was a city of artists. They made, tobacco products in China.
Well, that was what the English called terror bombings.
Yeah. And,
I mean, that's their language that they used.
Well, yeah, and it was Winston Churchill's idea that he cooked up to firebomb them. They dropped 700,000 phosphorus bombs over a 14-hour period, most of them over a 3-hour period, just cooked the whole city, liquefied human beings. The center of the city, I guess, was supposedly, at the height of the bombing, reached 1,600 degrees Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes, and I think someone else made the point earlier that the firebombing of Tokyo, like the firebombing of Dresden, there were so many refugees from the east, from the east of Germany, to trying to escape the Soviet Red Army, that they think that there could have been as many as 300,000 people killed in Dresden during that horrible night of firestorms. And so they're saying, well, gee, it wasn't even as bad as Hiroshima. But all of it, I mean, it was that World War II was this slaughterhouse that all sides participated in.
Yeah, it was a total theater of horrors. You've got that right. But this particular instance was, and you're talking about whether it was a military decision or a political decision, it completely, according to everything I've read about it, was a complete political decision just to slaughter Dresden to make a point to Stalin, because the Yalta conferences were coming up and Churchill wanted to show Stalin that he couldn't carve up Europe in the aftermath of the war in the way that he wanted. Churchill wanted to flex some Allied muscle. And the thing of it is they didn't even get to do the firebombing of Dresden before the Yalta conference. They had the Yalta conference and the weather didn't permit the firebombing. And then after the conference, they just said, oh, well, let's go ahead and do it. We'll confuse the enemy and drain their morale. And just a sickening thing, they didn't even go after whatever limited military targets might have been there, like the railroad yards. They didn't even found them.
Well, a lot of it, I think it was done at night. I mean, there was no, not even any longer the attempt to do any direct, try to figure out where those exact targets were. In fact, there's a I was going to say wonderful book, but it's so disturbing, I don't even know if I want to call it that, by Mike Davis called Dead Cities. And he has a lot of essays about cities. And one of them is about how the United States Bombing Survey Group created these replicas of German working class housing that was all connected.
And they made them out in the desert.
They made them out in the desert, and then they said, wait a minute, these are too dry, because it's not like that. And then they would soak them, and then they would see what effect the weapons had on them. They didn't attack the middle class and the upper class districts of Germany, because for one thing, they had separate houses, and when they attacked these working class districts, they would just be incinerated. Same way in the Tokyo bombings with these with the napalm, is that they had these paper houses of these working class districts. Now Churchill, who was an extreme right winger really in his politics, was extraordinarily fearful of another series of revolutions, as he in fact was correct, beginning in the after World War II, just as after had occurred after World War I. And one of the things, both to stop production during the war and to forestall an organized working class that had always opposed Hitler coming to power, was to physically destroy it.
Yeah.
I mean, to see again, I mean, the Second World War as this, you know, this pure and simple thing. Hey, look, we were attacked.
Yeah.
We were done pretty horribly. And the result of it.
This has connotations to our world today. I understand your point, and I'm not claiming to say that I'm the end-all, know-all, on World War II. No one is. But whether or not you can bomb someone into submission, kill them, or, you know, if Churchill was afraid of uprisings, which we're still dealing with that with Germany today, there's Nazi movements that still bubble up, slightly to the surface here today, but... So he was right to be that suspicious of that, but it's a matter of how you go about it. That Dresden incident, it was despicable at 10 in the morning. I imagine it was fairly clouded over with the turmoil and mess of 700,000 phosphorus bombs, but U.S. Mustangs flew in over Dresden and machine gunned down any survivors that they could see.
Yeah, they actually attacked... refugees at the railways. It is pretty horrible. So what we ought to see about this, this is not to say, gee, we're as bad as the Nazis, we're as bad as the Japanese, but this was an inter-imperial war. It was fought for control of markets. Essentially, the war in Asia was fought with Japan as to what sector of the world was going to control China and the other Asian countries that the Europeans and the U.S. had occupied, including the Philippines.
Yeah.
Like you're saying, gee, aren't those Japanese terrible attacking the United States in the Philippines? What the hell is the United States doing in the Philippines? That war is in a whole other story. All right, I got to roll on. Thanks for listening in Atlanta. I appreciate it.
All right, Peter, take care.
All right, bye-bye. Have some sad news. Top story right now. Peter Jennings, as it says here, the suave Canadian-born broadcaster who delivered the news to Americans each night in five separate decades, died tonight. He was 67 years old. He announced in April that he had lung cancer. And I don't want to start giving all you folks the lecture you've heard 100 times and the one you've probably given yourself, but please stop smoking, all right? I know it's hard. I mean, I've talked to it's the most addictive drug of all. In fact, that'll probably be part of what the conversation you hear tonight at 1 o'clock. But I don't know why I should take the death of a prominent man like Peter Jennings. But, because there's enough people in our everyday life. How much, what is it, 400,000? 400,000 people a year die as a result of smoking. And how many from marijuana is it? What is it? Is it 100,000? 200,000? Oh, no, wait, zero. Forgot it, zero. Well, another man done gone. Here's Bill, who called 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello, sir.
Hi.
Yeah, I wonder if you watch C-SPAN 2 Book TV.
No, I don't. I don't have cable. Sorry.
You're lucky.
Okay. Why?
Well, they're basically saying, what reason did Bush have to lie about weapons of mass destruction?
Yeah.
And I don't know if they ever heard your show.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because I think you've already stated why, what reasons he had to lie.
Yeah. Well, if he didn't lie, there wouldn't have been any reason to invade Iraq, right?
True.
Yeah.
No real reason.
Right. Well, I mean, they had their reasons. That was planned for a long time. And they thought they were going to be able to cakewalk into it. Remember, it was Secretary of War Rumsfeld who said, they'll greet us with rose petals. Or maybe it wasn't Rumsfeld. One of those guys.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Is it like greed, power, money has nothing to do with it?
Yeah, I'd say it's about oil. In fact, you go to my website, peterwerby.com, you can see just how little, I say that ironically, about oil it is. Yeah. Well, all right. Thank you for calling up, and thank you for having waited so long, Bill. I appreciate it. I'm going to read something. You know, see a lot of these yellow ribbons on the back of cars support our troops, and then you find out the very disturbing things about the way our troops are operating in Iraq and continue to operate. And people are responsible for their acts. Ultimately, they're not following orders. They like the people at Abu Ghraib, they knew what was right and wrong. Like, what was her name? England? Lindy? Wasn't that her name? Lindy England. She said she knew what was right and wrong. But think about the implications of this story. This is from the Los Angeles Times. The military says troops demanded, quote, rent from Iraqi vendors. California Army National Guard troops California Army National Guard troops charged unauthorized, off-the-books, so-called rent to Iraqi-owned businesses inside Baghdad's Green Zone in Iraq to raise money for a, quote, soldiers' fund, military officials and sources within the troops' battalion said Friday. The disclosure is the latest to emerge from a wide-ranging investigation into the conduct of the 1st Battalion of the 184th Infantry Regiment of the Guard, headquartered in Modesto, California. Military officials said that the battalion's commander, Lieutenant Colonel Patrick Fry, had been suspended and that one of the battalion's companies based in Fullerton, California, had been removed from patrol duties and restricted to an army base south of Baghdad. The businesses, a dry cleaner, convenience store, and the like, catered to U.S. soldiers and were located on the fringe of the U.S. military's operating base inside the Green Zone. The businesses were asked to pay the soldiers' rent. What is that called? It's called extortion. That's what mobs do. This is what gangsters do. They extort helpless businessmen who know if they don't pay the extortion, something bad's going to happen to them. So why do I bring this up? And a lot of people are saying, you know, you're looking at the worst apples in the barrel, and it's uncomfortable to hear bad things about the young men and women. In fact, some of them aren't even so young that are over there. Why even bring this up? Because corruption follows cynicism among officials. Corruption follows cynicism. And can the men and women that are over there be much less cynical about this war than we are? And think about their position. They could get killed at any time. Think how angry how many of them are about seeing their comrades being taken out by a sniper in a firefight, in a bombing attack. Think how much they just must despise the people that they either in general, like many of them do and you hear, or specifically people who they associate with those that have attacked them. And they know that Bush has lied. They know that support has eroded tremendously for the war over there. And they're probably thinking, like it's been posed so many times, who's going to be the last person to die for Bush's lie? So what comes out of that is not a campaign for democracy, because they see the corruption that's going on there. They know that the contractors there are milking the American public. By the way, let me get some open line. 313-298-WRIF. If you're ringing, hold on, please. Our producer will get to you in a second. And so that's when, you know, when that cynicism that comes out, that's when the corruption sets in. So that's, I think, what we have there. And the military says that it is going to cut our forces. Perhaps as many 20 to 30,000 troops are going to come home by next spring. Because Bush is saying, we got to get those troops out. I mean, not, you know, Bush. Karl Rove is saying, Dick Cheney is saying, we can't go into the 2006 elections with you having 38% support on the war in Iraq. But I thought he said if you said a timetable, this was going to only encourage the terrorists. I was saying earlier about our young men and women. Now, apparently, according to the Army Times, that Congress is asking, is being asked, this is by the Defense Department, is being asked to raise the maximum age for military recruits to 42 years old for all branches of the service. And get this. This is going to be a volunteer army. Does this sound more and more like a mercenary army? This would they want to include raising the maximum reenlistment bonus to $90,000. Bump up the age a little. Make it $100,000. And maybe your old pal Pete will get in on it all. For some reason or other, our phone screener is not grabbing those calls. So, Jay, are you with us? Pick him up if you're ringing. Hang on. Jay will get to him. Al, you're on the air. Thanks for calling from Inkster. Hi, it's Peter Werby.
Hey, Pete. How you doing tonight?
Doing good.
I want to return to a subject you had last week, the that article on the minimum wage.
Well, that was 7 days ago, so you'll have to remind me.
There's the Detroit News Free Press.
They did that series about people trying to exist, yeah.
Well, you missed the most infuriating part of it. There's a snippet in here. House Speaker Craig DeRoche, Republican Novi, called cynical a strategy. He said, quote, the voters of Michigan want our state to be more competitive. They know business costs are high here. DeRoche added that there is employability issues that haven't been a part of the debate. Quote, some people may only be employable at 5:15 an hour at certain stages of their life.
How about him?
Yeah. When they're entering the workforce or in their later years of their work life, or maybe they have physical or mental impairments, they may not be employable at 7:15 an hour. Basically saying anybody who draws minimum wage is either too young, too old, or crazy.
Yeah. Well, it's an excuse for paying slave wages. And, of course, the Republicans are always the biggest advocates of that. And they always put forth the same lie. If we raise it, they'll just raise the cost, and then inflation will come. And I mean, it's been shown time and time again not to be true. Now, how in the world does every European country have a higher minimum wage than the United States?
Well, also, Michigan has, you know, we have the second highest unemployment. Mississippi's doing its perpetual job of propping people from the bottom.
Right.
Other states have raised the minimum wage, and they have better economies, better employment figures, you know, better rates of unemployment than we do, and they've got a higher minimum wage. Who's to say it won't work here?
Okay.
I mean, nobody pointed that out in the article, you know.
Hmm. Sorry. I see what's happening here. You know, we have, excuse me, let me just interrupt here for 1 second. There's a problem, that Greater Media owns three stations in Detroit, and two others are in our building. And one of the other stations apparently has been off the air for 15 minutes. So our phone screener and producer, Jay Hudson, has gone over there to check out what's happening. Anyway, yeah, any pretense, which I don't have a great pretense, of objectivity drops when I hear that. These people, these Republicans, these legislators are just pure scum. These are guys that live the life of Riley, feed at the public trough. Usually they've gotten rich through some, I don't know, whatever. And they want to enforce a starvation wage on people. This is the 19th century. And by the way, ultimately, it's us, Al, because if we're going to sit still, I don't know about you, I consider myself well-waged. I'm not rich or anything like that, but I'm compensated and can live a decent middle-class life. But if people with conscience and people that are directly affected don't find a way eventually to protest against this. Well, the rich and the powerful, the rulers are going to do whatever, what they've done throughout history since the political state arose, use it to screw the average person. Pure and simple.
And we're getting screwed every day because I don't make a decent wage. I make $9 an hour, no health insurance.
No, that's not and that's unconscionable in a modern industrial society. And that puts us at the bottom. These people say, well, the United States is the best country in the world. If it's the best country in the world, why does it have the worst minimum wage? Why does it have the worst health care? Why does it have the lowest or the worst infant mortality rate?
Why do we work so hard? Why do we work so many hours?
Why do we have the highest number
of productivity?
Yeah, why do we have the highest productivity and the worst wages? Why do we have the worst vacations and on and on and on and on? Don't get me started. You already did. Thank you, Al. Appreciate your call. All right, so if you call now, it might be a bit before it gets picked up. I'll see what I can do. Actually, you know what I'm going to do? I am going to take a break right now and see if I can go help put out this, not fire, not real fire, but, you know, the problem. Be right back.
See you.
Genuine Draft Live.
I'm 22, in college. I really thought I had it together. I started doing OxyContin with my friends, and I didn't think it was a big deal. And then I started feeling weird without it. Now I just do it to get through the day. I used to always be in control.
Addiction to prescription narcotic opiate-based pain relievers like OxyContin, Vicodin, or codeine is dramatically increased. Addiction to these types of medications has been identified as a national health hazard. Opiate addiction destroys a person's sense of self, causing mental and physical decay, depression, anger, and despair. If you or someone you love want to break the addiction to heroin, methadone, or prescription-based painkillers, Detox Services can help. Don't be embarrassed. It doesn't matter what walk of life you come from. Detox Services can help you detoxify, get control of your life, detox comfortably in just one day, and no one will ever know. Call 1-877-DETOX-R-US. That's 877-DETOX-R-US. Or go to detoxservices.com. Get control of your life. Comfortably detox in just one day. Call Detox Services. 1-877-DETOX-R-US.
Hey, David, there's a lot of talk about interest-only mortgages these days. What's up with that?
Yeah, big time. I'll tell you. It's in the news. Interest-only is a great option for a consumer who either wants to use that cash flow and maybe reallocate it towards fully funding their 401k. Or paying down their credit card debt, or maybe even they can use the money that they would have paid on principal and do it anyway. And some folks have paid down their principal even more. So I think when you look at an interest-only mortgage, you want to make sure you're using it the right way. And the Smart Choice Loan at Rock Financial does just that. It helps our clients to be able to better manage their mortgage and use their funds so they could even pay down their mortgage faster by using an interest-only mortgage.
So that's what the mortgage experts are there for.
Give you good advice when you need it. First home, second home, vacation home, investment property, Rock Financial.
To make sure you pick the right thing.
You got it.
Okay, that's cool.
Yeah.
I'll call them at 800-333-ROCK and find out.
It's a good idea.
Or you can go to rockfinancial.com. Always go there. And they're a Quicken Loans Company equal housing lender on top of that all. So call them at 800-333-ROCK.
Call and ask about the smart choice.
Yeah.
It's interest only.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome back. And we have one more segment at 1 a.m. Please stay tuned for this incredible interview I did with Professor Ronald Siegel. a psychopharmacologist at the University of California Medical School at Los Angeles. His book, Intoxication, The Universal Drive for Mind-Altering Substances. Whoa. And he has something unique. He's not like saying, oh, man, we all want to get stoned. Actually, something like that. But you'll see. There was somebody on earlier that said that the problem with evolutionary theory, we've been talking about that in this intelligent design that these Christians are trying to sneak in through the back door and that are keeping it in the churches and where it belongs, are trying to create this public debate or this this religious debate in the public sphere. It doesn't belong there. Anyways, the one caller whose name I forget said that there is... that there's no transitional fossils. In other words, if there's evolution, what you see this fossil, that fossil, what he's doing is challenging natural selection and genetic modification to create higher species. Anyways, the caller who claimed that there are no transitional fossils to support evolution needs to hear one word, Archaeopteryx. Basically, it is believed to be the link between lizards and birds. There are others. Go to talkorigins.org, like in origins, the origins of stuff, talkorigins.org for a complete list. But fundies, in other words, fundamentalists, like that caller will dismiss it, I'm sure. The problem is that if you ask anti-evolutionists what they are willing to accept as transitional, you won't get an answer. Add to that the fact that fossil formation is a function of luck more than anything else, and their standard of proof becomes impossible to meet. Jeff writes, intelligent design, my ass. Well, the point being is that science needs to keep continually challenging itself, just as evolutionary theory needs to, and I think it does from everything. I'm not an expert in that, and I think that, that it's in transition like everything else. Okay, let's continue on. Here's Dave and Taylor. Dave, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, Pete.
Hi.
It's been a while. I don't know if you still care or not, but they only come out at night was Edgar Winter.
Oh, that's right.
That was their big album.
That's right.
And it was Ray Manzarek.
Ray Manzarek, yeah. I was
a short-lived program in the Detroit market.
I was having, what do they call it, a brain fart, right? It just didn't come out. You know, one of the things, and I appreciate what you're saying very much because it's important that when I make mistakes, and I do, because as I've said before, I'm bringing all of this out of my brain. I don't have three producers. I don't have, I'm not finding facts off the internet. So I'm always very, very appreciative when people call up and with any factual error. So I appreciate that a lot.
Well, maybe you could do a little bit more studying when you do those promos for little Steven's Underground Garage. A little more studying. You just got to sit there with your little spots to throw in.
You're right. All right, thank you.
All right, Pete.
Appreciate it.
Bye.
Bye-bye. If you don't understand that totally, it don't matter. Jim in Woodhaven. Hi, you're on the air. Hey, Jim.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Pete, I've listened to you for about 20 years, and I don't disagree with you, or I don't agree with you too often. Definitely on religion, I agree with you, but as far as the Hiroshima bomb and the Nagasaki bomb, I don't know. I think that saved a lot of lives, and I wish it would have dropped one on Tokyo. I mean, that sounds bad, but
yeah, it does kind of sound bad. I mean, it's filled with people. I mean, it was filled with people just like the ones that live in Woodhaven, except they lived somewhere else and in an earlier time. So if you can imagine, like, an atomic bomb dropping on Woodhaven and everyone, you and everyone around you being incinerated.
Well, I mean, Pearl Harbor, I mean, we didn't attack Japan.
No. They carried out a sneak attack on a military facility in order to initiate a war with the United States and with the European powers for who would control Asia. So the United States, along with the Netherlands and France and England, may have been others, were controlling Asian nations, exploiting them terribly. And Japan said, hey, Why have those Westerners doing it when we can exploit them and what have you? So that the fact that we were trying to do that over in Asia put us on a collision course with another empire. That's why I said it was an inter-imperial war. Of course, who always suffers are the common people, whether you're the 400,000 or so GIs, American GIs that died, or whether you're the hundreds of thousands of Japanese that get incinerated. It's always these big rich guys, the rulers, that have all these grand ideas for empire that wind up with mountains of corpses of the ordinary people, and they get off scot-free. The guy earlier was talking about the bombing of Germany and these catastrophic bombings, these fire bombings of like Dresden and Hamburg. 90% of the Nazis survived. 90% of the Nazi Party members survived because they lived out in the middle class areas. And who got chewed, as usual, as I said, was the ordinary worker, many of probably who despised Hitler because ultimately he wouldn't, you know, he controlled 100% what labor unions could do as well as everyone else. All right, thank you. Appreciate that call. Where are we going next here? Let's go to Rob in, is it Bradford, Rob?
Yes, sir. How are you?
Where's Bradford?
I'm actually up in Canada, just north of Toronto.
Oh, yeah, I know where that is. Sorry.
And I'm a first-time listener to your show. I put the station on about 5-8 minutes ago, and I heard your comments about the war and the lack of support to your government. I think the one thing I'd like to say to you is that although the Canadian government, through the whole Iraqi situation, wasn't very supportive in the scheme of things, the people of Canada greatly appreciate and support what you're doing in terms of trying to rid the world of terrorism.
Wait, Rob, you can't just make this up off the top of your head. The Canadian people, from every poll I've ever seen, like 75 and 80% oppose the war in Iraq, and Bush is held in such ill regard by the vast majority of Canadians.
Well, talking to people who I know, I'm not going to say I know 8 million people in Canada, but talking through conversations with a lot of people, I know that we're probably not very war-friendly, but we're much stronger against terrorism. And
yeah.
That said, I think that regardless of polls and regardless of what the Canadian government has done in lack of support through the last few years, I honestly do believe that you do have a very good percentage of Canadian supporters who are on your side in terms of ridding the world of terrorism.
Well, I think that everyone everywhere, with the exception of some fairly awful people, want to rid the world of terrorism. All right, thanks, Rob. Thanks for finding us, and thanks for making our program international. I definitely appreciate that. Here's Jake in Detroit. Jake, hi. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. How you doing?
Good.
I'm a very long-time listener. I've been listening since I was in high school, sir.
You're welcome.
I'm an ex-Marine Corps infantry. I was in Iraq. And I completely agree with what you're saying. This war is BS.
Huh.
And I'm pissed off.
Well,
I'm pissed. As far as my grandfather was in the Army and he was on Saipan, and I do agree with the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I'm a history major at a local school in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not a thing of like terrorism. This is not a thing of like democracy. This culture. I went to a military college in the South, and I took Arabic as a foreign language and a predominant study in the culture of it. This is not. They are not ready to see a McDonald's on the corner. They didn't welcome us with rose petals.
Yeah.
They did not.
No, I know.
And I'm pissed. And I don't feel any amount of pride for what I've done and what I was in the Crete when it first started 2 years ago. I was in the Crete and I didn't see any rose petals. I didn't see any happiness. This is all an aspect of economical gain for imperialistic Bush.
Well, I think you're right, and I think someone particularly that joins the Marine usually is highly motivated, and when one feels used and abused, I can understand.
I grew up in government-subsidized housing. I was injured over there. I have disability from the VA, not from the Marine Corps, but I have disability from the VA.
What do you mean?
Okay. I was hurt in Iraq.
Yeah?
I had a parasitic infection. I lost parts of my intestines.
Oh, boy.
But that was my job, and I would not be pissed if it was worth it, if it was worthwhile. Dude, should we have gone into Afghanistan, sir? You may not agree with my standpoint on this, sir, but yes, we should have gone into Afghanistan, not against the Afghanistani people, but the people who projected and funded 9/11.
Yeah, exactly.
Not Iraq. That was wrong. That was wrong. I grew up in government-subsidized housing. Never knew my father. And I went over there. And I am pissed off because I know places in Detroit that are just as bad as places in Iraq.
You know what?
You're laying off goddamn teachers in Detroit. You're laying off teachers in Detroit. And you're closing down schools, and you're going to talk to me about concepts of the no child left behind concept of education. That's BS. And I'm mad.
You know what I would suggest, and there's a way to, you know, your anger is righteous. And there is, I'm trying to find, let me see what, if do you have use of a computer?
100% of the time, I agree with everything you say, sir.
Do you have access to a computer?
Yes, sir, I do.
All right, there's a group called Iraq Veterans Against the War, and it's IVAW.net.
IVAW.net.
So not .com or .org, but .net. IVAW.net. And why I suggest going to that is to see that there's other vets that went over there, fought honorably, intended to do what they considered a service to their country, and came back and looked at things considerably different. But
I'm mad. You know what, sir? I feel as though I was lied to. I'll be perfectly honest with you. I'm 25. I'm just about 25, and when I went over there, I was 22. And I went over there pumped, feeling like I'm doing something right for mankind. And you know what? I came home? BS.
Yeah.
BS. What the heck did I do over there?
Well, let me do this. I hear your anger, and...
Not at you, sir. It's not...
No, I understand that.
Yes,
and.
Sir.
And you've let us know in very powerful terms, and I think people feel that. Start investigating. Start with those folks. See if they make any sense to you. See if it's a way in which that you could take that anger and use it. Because I'm just looking at my website.
Go to law school.
Well, that's good. That's a good thing. But
I'm a socialist too. I'm a socialist. I'm a socialist. I believe in health care reform. You know, it's very easy for President Bush to say, forget health care reform. It's very easy to say that when you're making high six figures, low seven figures, when your freaking family has full freaking coverage. But when my neighbor downstairs can't feed his freaking sickle cell anemia kid, there's a problem.
I agree.
And they pay taxes. The people downstairs, me, they pay taxes. I pay taxes. Everybody talks about Big Brother. Where's Big Brother when I need him? When you need him? When your kid needs him?
Well, I hear you. You know, I'm gonna have to move on. I got to get some other people on. I want to thank you. Thank you so much for calling.
Yes, sir. Have a good evening, sir.
Bye bye now. Bye bye now. Wow. Here's a letter came in. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Very similar from Paul. Why, Peter, is it that I'm in the Army and trying to help rid the world of terrorists that don't exist? Michigan is going to hell so much that I couldn't get a job in the auto industry, even if I wanted to, and the world is still polluting at 10 times the rate it was last year. I mean, nothing changes and it gets worse. I just wonder what's going on. I will try to catch up on your show, find out about more of the issues. P.S. Has Bush apologized to London for the bombing yet? I mean, it's his fault. He won't stop this war on terror, and how many more people will die? Well, people say, wait a minute, there's terrorists out there. We better keep up the war. What we got to do is twofold. One thing is, I think I say this frequently, is that we got to do police work to make sure that people don't operate in the manner that occurred in Madrid or in London or in New York. That's unacceptable. Then we got to get to the reasons why this all occurs, and that means disengaging from the Middle East totally. What else was here? Something. Oh, yeah. My website, peterwerbe.com, peterwerbe.com. There's a number of links right when you open it to quotes. Dead soldier's mom asked Bush, why did you kill my son? Cindy Sheehan, and I'm trying to remember the name of her group. It could be Military Families. If you go to my website, you can find all this. But anyway, she's in Crawford. She's in Crawford, Texas, wanting answers from Bush. And actually, the Crawford, Texas paper, which is very anti-Bush, has coverage of it, which is on there as well. In one of the articles about the Marines dying last week, 14 of them or 19? Tell Bush to get our soldiers out of there now before any more of our soldiers die, she said. This is getting to be ridiculous. And 39-year-old ex-Marine Daryl Stewart said, why doesn't President Bush send his daughters over there? If this is such a campaign against terror, for democracy, why aren't his daughters... Why aren't, what is it, Jenna and Barbara, isn't that their name? Why aren't they over there? Wouldn't you think that they would take the burden upon their shoulders that that Bush is expecting that generation to carry? All right, let's go and get a few more calls here. I don't know, this doesn't have a name attached to it. Hi, it's Night Call, you're on the air. Who's this?
Hey, Peter, my name's Jim.
Hi, Jim, where are you calling from?
I'm from Westland.
Go ahead, you're on the air.
I have a little story, and this is a little question. I guess, I don't know, we should have called earlier. Maybe your listeners could have helped me out with it. I got pulled over with a dime bag on me about a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And it was funny just because I was coming out of a predominantly black neighborhood, but which, by the way, was right in the suburbs. I mean, it wasn't like I was coming out of a ghetto or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then they pulled me over. I knew why they were pulling me over, and I knew it was illegal, and I did it, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't, like, buy it on the street or anything. You know, it's from a friend, but... I have to go, you know, get everything taken care of. But, like, for legal aid, like, how do people without, you know, the funds, like, get a lawyer that's going to actually help them and not, like,
Is the charge?
Possession of a gram.
Is that a misdemeanor or a felony?
Misdemeanor.
I don't know if I don't know whether legal aid will, you got to somehow find out from the court whether they will provide you with an attorney. A dime bag? I mean, that's like...
That's all. The cop actually told me it was pretty funny. He's like, why didn't you just go out and buy a six-pack or a bottle of liquor? And I'm thinking to myself, are you serious? Like, you know, I should go do that.
But you mean like a dime, like in $10?
Yeah.
You can still get marijuana for $10?
Just a gram, yeah.
I'm going to call you after. No, I'm only kidding. I'm only kidding.
The thing is, I'm going to NA and I'm trying to do everything I can to make sure the judge knows I'm serious.
Well, that's good. That's a good thing to do. But I would try to check. I mean, what county do you live in? Wayne County. Well, good luck. But there is like a Wayne County Legal Aid Society that hopefully they'll have a human being that will pick up the phone and you'll be able to get some information. And at least ask them, can I ask for a court-appointed attorney?
Well, they said I could get one at my arraignment, but I'm just worried about them not helping me, actually.
Well, that's not it's not the best legal counsel. That's why you have so many poor people in jail. And,
I mean, 'cause I don't have, like, a record or anything. You know, yeah. I guess this is the first time I ever got busted for anything. And, like, and I don't commit crimes on a regular or nothing. This is, I feel pretty dumb about it, you know.
How old are you, if I may ask?
25.
25, and are you employed?
I have two jobs.
Yeah, do you have a, like, wife or anything?
No, I'm a single guy.
Okay. Well, if you're, you know, I think probably, with or without a lawyer, it's you probably will wind up with probation.
I know that.
Yeah. I mean, and you ought to ask, what can you do to get that expunged from your record? In other words, oftentimes on misdemeanors, if you're, if you don't commit any crime for X amount of time, that they'll allow that to disappear from your record. But you need some advice. You need some information.
Yeah,
and
it's hard when you can't afford it. You know, lawyers are expensive. It's like,
I know.
I was checking into cheap ones, and I'm like, oh, my God. I'm like, you know, because I make, you know, I have two jobs that I just, you know, I barely get by like everybody else, you know, and I have to work two jobs. You know, I'm actually at work right now, and it's just kind of tough. And like I said, I feel dumb about it, and I knew it was legal when I did it. I don't think it's anything, I don't think it's immoral.
No, it's a stupid law.
He told me to go get a bottle of liquor. Like, so, like,
yeah.
People die every day that way. But, you know, who's the last person, you know, overdosed on pot?
Nobody. Nobody. And there's, like, 25 million alcohol addicts that cause all sorts of difficulties for themselves, with their family, and cause deaths and what have you. And, yeah, they're bottling up our legal system. See, I mean, you know, with that kind of crap.
Thanks.
All right. Hey, listen, stay tuned for this interview. I think you'll appreciate it.
Okay, thanks, Ben.
All right, bye-bye. Man. All right, we may have time for another call. Tom's in Sterling Heights. Tom, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
Good, good. You know, I was really just kind of looking to pretty much touch on really anything. I actually went through a little situation myself with an OUIL just recently. And I heard your guy calling, you know, he was inquiring about his attorneys or whatever for his marijuana thing. When he said that the cop told him, why don't you go out and buy a bottle of liquor or get a six-pack or something, I guess truthfully, when he couldn't understand that, I can see his point of view, but at the same time, it's legality. You know what I mean?
Sure.
I mean, weed is just, sorry, I got my radio going in the background.
Yeah, turn it off. Well, you got to know that if you're going to smoke reefer, you're an outlaw, and there's
you're not an outlaw. I mean, but you are. It's a misdemeanor. Far put you from.
Well, you're an outlaw. You are outside. You are operating outside the law, and there's always a possibility that what happened to him could happen to you, to who's ever doing it.
It can happen to anybody.
Exactly.
I mean, anybody that experiments with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's right. I always say I experimented with marijuana in college, and it was successful. All right, unfortunately, I got to end the show, so thank you very much. At least this segment of it. I got two very incredible interviews coming up. One with a professor from California who has written the book Intoxication, the Universal Drive for Mind-Altering Substances. And then a friend of mine, Herb Boyd, in his book, Civil Rights, a pretty interesting historical look at a credible period in our history. All right, thanks for listening, thanks for calling, and we'll talk live next week.
Call 1-800-359-TALK or visit FamilyTalkOnline.com for a free parent guide on underage drinking. Responsibility matters. Anheuser-Busch, St. Louis, Missouri.
Since their recent formation, As Cities Burn has shared the stage with everyone from Norma Jean to As I Lay Dying. Based out of Baton Rouge, As Cities Burn combines spacey metal riffs with hardcore breakdowns, layered underneath soaring melodies and guttural screaming. One part metal, one part hardcore. This band has earned their reputation the old-fashioned way through relentless touring and great songwriting. For fans of Under Oath and The Bled, stop by any DMRC location and pick up As Cities Burn. We're
the DMRCR, Record Time in Ferndale, Rockabilly's in Utica, Switched On in Novi, Discs and Tapes Unlimited in Howell, Culture Clash in Toledo, Record Time in Roseville, and the Rockbox in Southgate. All stores are members of the Detroit Music Retailers Collective. Be independent, shop independent. Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix, the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-824-6692. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. Call now for a brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more. 1-800-824-6692. Programs vary by campus. Call University of Phoenix now. 1-800-824-6692. That's 1-800-824-6692.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Some of you probably remember that have listened for a while. I continually make the same joke whenever we talk about the war on drugs. I always say, war on drugs? I can't even drive on drugs. Well, I don't do that. And yet the challenge of intoxicating substances in our culture continues with medical problems, with legal situations. And I thought our guest today would be really valuable in giving us some insight into this, quote, problem. The book is Intoxication, and the subtitle is extraordinarily interesting and telling. It's The Universal Drive for Mind-Altering Substances. The author is Ronald K. Siegel, Ph.D. He's a psychopharmacologist on the faculty of the Department of Psychiatry and Biobehavioral Sciences. That's at the UCLA School of Medicine, and he's the author also of Fire in the Brain and Whispers, The Voices of Paranoia. He's a leading authority in the social and psychological effects of drug use, and the author of numerous articles on the subject. He lives in Los Angeles, where we're talking to him. Ronald Siegel, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter. I'm delighted to be here with you.
Now, as you say in your introduction, that is extremely intriguing in and of itself, that that people have always used intoxicants throughout history, that every part of the world people pursue intoxication to the extent that it is literally a fourth drive. Is that below food, water, and sex, or above?
Well, it's probably on par with food, water, and sex, and I'd like to go back to your introduction where you mentioned war on drugs. I can't even drive on drugs. You made that little quip. Actually, we do war on drugs. Drugs are a very important part of modern warfare. Our pilots in long-distance flights in the Middle East use what's called go pills. These are amphetamines, like amphetamine and methamphetamine, to stay awake for long missions. They also use it on the ground. And in fact, in World War II, it was really a war of amphetamine addicts against each other. The United States government dispensed millions of doses of amphetamines to our ground forces. The Nazi panzers were using it. Adolf Hitler himself used it. He was the world's first methamphetamine addict. It was coming out of German labs.
Really, the first?
Yes, the first, and the most extreme example.
Sure.
And even the Japanese kamikaze pilots used it. Now we're finding that some of the insurgents in Iraq and some of the terrorists in the Middle East are high on methamphetamine.
Wow, that's amazing. And now the police chiefs who met recently have said that methamphetamine production, distribution, and use is America's number one drug problem.
Yes, but it's also a medicine.
Yeah.
It is also a medicine that we use in psychiatry for treatment of depression. It's used for attentional deficit disorders with children, with young children. And it's also used in the treatment of obesity, although that's not a recommended use in the United States, illustrating that it's not the magic of this chemical that turns a drug into a poison. It's the pattern of use and the dosage.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing inherently evil about methamphetamine or amphetamine or any drug. These are simply chemical substances with certain physiological properties and behavioral possibilities. And I submit to you that all of the drug problems that we have in the world today are a result of these patterns of use gone haywire.
Sure.
Now, we've always done this, as you started to ask me about it being the fourth drive. In every age, in every part of the planet, people have tried to pursue intoxication with plant drugs, with alcohol, with all kinds of mind-altering substances. But what we learned is, surprisingly, we're not the only ones to do this. My research teams have been out all over the planet, looking at animals engaging in the natural pursuit of intoxicants. We've watched elephants going after fermented fruit and getting tipsy and high. We've watched bees guzzling stupefying nectars. We've watched llamas chewing on coca leaves in the Andean Mountains. In every animal species, practically, we find animals accidentally or deliberately going after these intoxicants.
Catnip.
Catnip. Cats eagerly go after not only catnip, but a variety of other aromatic pleasure plants. And then they roll around and they play with imaginary butterflies and imaginary mice. What is happening here is that animals, including us, are medicating ourselves. We're trying to change the way in which we feel. Now, nobody wants this to be dangerous. Nobody wants people to live out their lives inside crack houses, or dying from tobacco cancer, or killed or run over by drunk drivers. But when we, whether we get up in the morning with a cup of coffee or a sniff of cocaine, we take a break from work with a cigarette or a beer, we relax with a cocktail or marijuana, or we try to get to sleep with a pill that we purchased by prescription from the pharmacy, or one that we bought over the counter, or one that we bought from our neighborhood dealer. We use drugs to change the way we feel, and it's natural. It is natural because our brains are three-pound sacks of chemicals. And, of course, we're more than that, Peter. But we are that, too. And these chemicals have molecular structures that are very similar to the plants that we're attracted to the compounds out there in our planet that we have an affinity for. So it's natural that we should find ourselves going after these, just like our animal ancestors did. As a matter of fact, most of our major drugs were discovered by people watching animals.
Hmm.
Coffee was discovered by people watching goats nibbling on these coffee beans and then become abnormally frisky. And they copied the behavior and they found that they became, well, abnormally frisky.
Well, Ron Siegel, this is so fascinating. I'm almost tempted not to ask questions and just say go. But let's back up into some of these, and because one of your chapters, let me just open right to that, is called "Discovery of Poisons and Intoxicants: A Trip of Goats." But before that, too, the origins of plant drugs. So you have rooted in almost original human experience, let alone animals, a desire for intoxication. I can somehow just hear Bob Dylan singing "Everybody Must Get Stoned," which is the authorities, if you will, look pretty askance on that situation because, say no to drugs. I mean, are you saying that it's inherent in the human?
Go ahead. Yes, it is inherent. It functions with the same vigor and persistence as our drives of sex, hunger, and thirst. And we know we can't suppress it. We can only try to deal with it, just like you can't outlaw sex. But you try to make sex safer, more controllable, and eliminate the risks. You can't outlaw hunger, but you try to make the food safer. You try to make the water safer. You try to make the environment safe. Now, our environment includes our use of these plant intoxicants and synthetic ones, but they're not safe in the way in which we use them, and that's what we've learned from the animals. The animals have been doing this for millions of years, and they've survived. They don't have these problems. Why do we have all these problems? I'll tell you why. Because we're screwing around with Mother Nature. You take the coca leaf. Andean Indians have been eating the coca leaf, which is the source of cocaine, for a long, long time without any problems. It's a medicine for them. It's the children use it. They have all kinds of chewing gums and elixirs and tonics and cough drops and even even toothpaste made out of this. And that first brush in the morning really wakes you up.
Yeah, I was going to say, better than a cup of coffee.
But what and animals chew this. Llamas chew this. A lot of other animals eat the plant without any problem because the amount of cocaine in the plant is a very small amount, just enough to get you stimulated. About the same amount of caffeine that's in the coffee plant, just enough to tell animals to stay away because it tastes slightly bitter and they try to keep that's why the plant makes these chemicals as a defensive agent, as a chemical defense to keep animals from eating too much of them so they can survive. And our goal is not to eat too much, but what have we done?
Refined it.
Being the clever primates that we think we are, we've torn open the coca leaf, pulled out the cocaine, concentrated it down, figured out ways to get it directly into our body, like through our nose and into our veins, and then we ask why we have a drug problem?
Hmm. Well, isn't there a cultural factor as well? Because in American consumer culture, sort of the ethos is consume as much as possible. So you get an intoxicated feeling, you say, that's wonderful. So rather than doing it once a month or within religious ceremonies or something like that, the idea comes, let's do it 10 times a day.
That's right. The plants control the amount, and if we just use the plants, we'd probably be okay, just like the Andean Indians are. Or take the elephants. The elephants, when they're stressed on the savannas of Africa and in the jungles of Borneo and Sumatra, they migrate to the fallen fermented fruit of different trees, and they gobble it up. And this we believe from our studies that this relieves some of the stress.
They're
getting. But you don't get a lot of alcohol from fermented fruit. It's like a very weak wine, very low percentage, maybe at most 7 or 8% at most.
Yeah, Ronald Siegel is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. The book is Intoxication, The Universal Drive for Mind-Altering Substances. The book originally came out in hardcover in 1989. It's been out of print, and Park Street Press has brought it out again. I'll have a link to it on my website. Tell us more about the elephants, because you were trying to get these guys drunk at one point, weren't you? Tell us about that episode.
Well, they won't naturally. I mean, they will accidentally break into moonshine operations in Africa, and they're attracted by the smell. That's what really attracts them, and they'll gobble up a lot more potent alcohol than they could ever find in nature. But when they're in nature and they're just eating the fermented fruit, they don't really have a problem. They don't get drunk. They don't get tipsy. They refuse to take large amounts. And they're very sensible about this.
But no, I was telling the story that you had different levels of alcohol, and they had their choice of up to 50% alcohol.
Oh, they would. Yeah, they chose the ones that were closest to the natural fermented fruit ones,
which was about 7%, like beer.
About 7%. They are using this to medicate themselves, just like during the Vietnam War. The water buffalo that were within earshot of the battles would break out of their grazing areas and wander into opium poppy fields and gobble up the opium poppies. We believed that the reason they did that was to relieve the stress of all of that firefighting and all of that noise and combat. And after the war, they went into withdrawal. They became addicted. They kept on doing it. They suffered the same consequences that we did. They went into withdrawal just like our soldiers went into withdrawal. We saw some of these water buffalo, twitching and getting sick and being, unhappy water buffalo, I would like to say.
Now, tell me a little about addiction. I mean, you're a psychopharmacologist in the faculty of the UCLA School of Medicine, so this must be something that you're very knowledgeable about. There are people that I've known, and probably a lot of the listeners, maybe even in their family, maybe even themselves, that have had problems of addiction, and no matter what happens, no matter what kind of programs that they're in, they keep going back to it. And we can easily say they're self-medicating. I mean, that's kind of the popular phrase these days. But what's going on in the brain that the person can't control their behavior to kind of come into compliance with what at least the law expects from them?
Well, there are alterations in the brain chemistry as well as in the body's physiology that require continued use of the drug just to feel good, just to maintain the present state, and then they may want to do more to achieve that first euphoric high that they got a long time ago but can never get again because they develop tolerance to most of these drugs. So it's a never-ending cycle of chasing that high. And the problem is that we know enough now about addiction that we know that people can't control their use of drugs. They can't control their use of over-the-counter drugs, even prescription drugs. More people die from prescription drug abuse than from all of the illegal drug deaths put together. It's not just, and here on prescription drugs, you have doctor's orders, prescription label controlling the use, a pharmacy controlling the manufacture and the packaging of it, and still people abuse it. We need drugs that control themselves, just like the coca leaf controls itself. We need drugs that can't be broken open. We need time release intoxicants. First of all, we have to accept the fact, and I hope after reading my book, most people would agree with me, that people are medicating themselves with drugs to change the way they feel. In this sense, let's talk about drugs as medicines, and let's make our medicines safe. Not just our medicines for cancer, not just our medicines for depression, not just our medicines for headaches or for rheumatoid arthritis, but our medicines for stress, our medicines for relaxation, our medicines for stimulation, all the reasons why we use drugs like cocaine and alcohol and tobacco, things like that. Let's make them as safe as we possibly can, and we have the technology now to do that.
Would you say that's true? I want to keep reminding people of the book's title, Intoxication, the Universal Drive for Mind-Altering Substances. My guest is its author, Ronald K. Siegel. Would you say the same is true with the social use of alcohol? In other words, if I'm having a dinner, and as soon as the four of us and the first bottle of wine goes away and the second bottle comes out, well, there's a lot more laughing, and everyone seems to enjoy themselves a little more without, no one's getting sloshed or anything like that. It's consumed over a couple of hours. It's with food, but it definitely plays a role in mind alteration.
Yes. The problem is with the alcohol itself. This is not safe. This is a poison. This is one of the few drugs. Remember the old ads on TV? They may still be around. This is your brain on drugs, and they show some eggs frying in a frying pan. Well, there are very few drugs that actually fry your brain, but alcohol is one of them. It will produce permanent, irreversible brain damage. LSD will not. Cocaine will not. But alcohol will, and it does kill. And more people, I think it's something like 500 people a day die from alcohol related diseases in America, and 1,000 a day from tobacco. These are the real poisons. We need to have, recognizing that you have just described a social situation in which it is very useful to have a drug that produces some disinhibition, perhaps some relaxation, some sociability, but we have to have a safe one. Dream with me for a moment, Peter, and
love
your
to.
Listeners. What would be wrong if we had perfectly safe intoxicants? I mean drugs that deliver the same effects as our popular ones but never cause dependency, disease, dysfunction, or death. Now imagine an alcohol-type substance that never caused addiction, never caused liver disease or hangovers or impaired driving or a workplace problem. What would be wrong with that? Would you care to inhale a perfume mist that is enjoyable as marijuana or tobacco, but as harmless as clean air? They exist. This is not science fiction. These drugs do exist. They're in the laboratories now. People are working with them and have been for some time.
Actually, I thought you were going towards marijuana.
No, marijuana is not a clean drug. I mean, it's not. I don't want to get into the argument of is it safer than tobacco or alcohol or this sort of thing. It's not the perfectly safe intoxicant that we would want to put the good housekeeping stamp of approval on. And not only that, but we not only have to have the safe drugs to work with, but we have to have the safe environments in which they can be used. You still don't want people using the safe alcohol behind the wheel of a car.
Sure.
You still don't want young children doing it. Now, we have rules now that govern that. You can't drink and drive. You got to go to a bar or a licensed restaurant. You can't be under a certain age to drink. And yet, it's still a disaster because the drug itself is a disaster. But there are some drugs that I talk about in the book, which are like alcohol, but cut out after 30 minutes, you're sober.
Oh.
I mean, imagine that. 30 minutes after taking it, you're sober. You got to take it again. And no matter how much you take, it's still only going to be effective for about 30 minutes. These are the kinds of designs that can be done with the molecular architecture that we now can master. With the technology that is available, we can make, just like we're trying to make safer drugs for cancer with less side effects and more benefits, safer drugs for gastro reflux disorder with less problems, safer drugs for cholesterol lowering with less liver problems. We're constantly spending billions of dollars a year on all of that. And yet we spend nothing on trying to clean up the drugs that everybody is using and that everybody's having problems with, the culprits of the war on drugs, the so-called recreational drugs, the so-called non-medical drugs. I submit to you they're not non-medical. They're medical. We're doing this for medical reasons, to change the way in which we feel.
How would you react to critics that would say that you're an advocate for drugs? I'll tell you. I mean, I'm thinking, wow, where is that substance? I mean, I would take it in a heartbeat because it wouldn't be illegal. I mean, I have actually used intoxicating substances that were, and I'm not going to name them on the air necessarily, but weren't illegal, and then, although there was no problem with them, became illegal. And so this would be the same thing. But you just describing that, it was almost like you describing a good meal to someone when I'm hungry. I'd be there in a heartbeat.
There are a lot more drugs out there that are not illegal, but would become illegal as soon as they became popular and became a problem of control.
Mm-hmm.
Ecstasy was legal for a long, long time.
Right.
Until it got out of control, and then people now have been dying. There have been deaths reported from it. Even though at the same time, there's tremendous promise in the medicinal use of this drug in psychotherapy and a variety of other treatment modalities. So again, it's not an evil drug necessarily. It's just a chemical, and it has to be used in a safe way, both therapeutically as well as non-medically.
Well, if you got bikers in Kansas and one cauldron have meth and the other one have ecstasy, and you're depending on them for purity of what you're putting inside your body, it's a little scary.
Yeah, we have a lot right now. A lot of the ecstasy that's coming into this country that's made elsewhere, in Thailand and elsewhere, appears to be contaminated with some date rape drugs.
Ugh.
We found that.
Which is the opposite of its what it's supposed to produce in you.
Correct, except that if you want to think about sexual disinhibition as being something that's implicated by the word ecstasy, it goes in that direction. It moves people in that direction.
This implication. Give me another word. What's
Did Did I misspeak?
I don't know. Maybe it was my brain. But I thought that was a word. Or maybe it's just a Bushism, like you misunderestimate or whatever. Anyways, you said that, run through again, that they would put this date rape drug in ecstasy for what reason?
To help disinhibit an individual.
Okay. All right.
To sexually disinhibit them.
Maybe I missed it. Maybe I was thinking about...
And I mean, it's still the most common date rape drug in America is still alcohol.
Yeah, sure. Sure. Well, we only have about a minute and a half left with you, Ron Siegel. This all said, it looks like absolutely none of this is on the political agenda. The war on drugs, in fact, they just announced in Washington that they were going to focus more on suppressing marijuana users and sellers and growers, even though meth seems to be the real problem as a police chief. See, I mean, we don't seem to have gone any farther than reefer madness in the 30s.
No, I think we have to control some of the drugs that are out there, and I applaud some efforts to do that because they are out of control and they are dangerous and they do result in a lot of killing. And I wish we had as much direction, war against tobacco. Can you imagine if some other country wanted to send eradication teams into the Kentucky tobacco fields? How we would react, and yet we're sending our helicopter eradication teams into the Andean coca regions.
At a few billion a year. You know, unfortunately, we're completely out of time. This interview went by faster than anyone I remember in a while, and I've looked through this, read a couple of the chapters. I'm reading it cover to cover. I would recommend this to you listeners as well. The book is Intoxication, The Universal Drive for Mind-Altering Substances. Ronald K. Siegel, Ph.D., is the author, and it is available from Park Street Press. Is there a website connected with this?
Park Street Press has a website. The book can be purchased, in a number of different places on there. But I would encourage readers to get the new edition, this one that you just mentioned, because it does have a lot of stuff about methamphetamine, and it's an updated edition with a lot of new material in it.
Well, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you very much, Peter.
To protecting men in divorce. Call Adam today at 248-356-ADAM. That's 248-356-ADAM.
Dear Mr. H, Mr. Two, and Mr. O, it's time for us to become reacquainted, to break out the suits and the towels. Time to dive into every day and every cooler filled with the signature taste of Budweiser. Light, crisp, clean, and pure. You guys are making the water, and we're jumping in.
I'm looking up, all sun is hanging high. I gotta move, if I don't, I'm gonna fry. I hit the water and my worries drift away. I think it's gonna be a great, great day. Ooh, I'm ready. Ooh, bring it on.
Budweiser Beer, Anheuser-Busch, St. Louis, Missouri.
Home
Homeowners, are you behind on bills, deep in debt, tired of hearing no from other lenders? Call American Equity Mortgage at 888-229-7699 and hear yes instead.
As a loan officer at American Equity Mortgage, saying yes is a big part of my job, even to people with less than perfect credit.
American Equity Mortgage makes yes simple and fast. You can apply on the phone, in person, or at AmericanEquity.com. Get approval in hours and close as fast as 1 week.
American Equity Mortgage wants you to have the money you need right now. We can help you pay off those high-interest credit cards and save you hundreds of dollars every month. It's easy. Just say yes
to American Equity Mortgage. Toll-free, 888-229-7699, and we'll say yes to you. American Equity Mortgage, open till 8, 888-229-7699, or apply online at AmericanEquity.com.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. As you know, the show is mostly oriented around interviewing authors, and books are very important to me. Most of the important things I've learned are from books, from authors, and television, like next to zero. And sometimes people say, well, I'll mention a subject, and they'll say, what book can you recommend? And it's odd. Often I say, gee, I don't know. Well, if someone said, tell me the story of the civil rights movement, the African-American struggle for equality beginning in the 1950s and even a little earlier, I finally have a book in my hands that I would be overwhelmed to recommend. It's called We Shall Overcome. It's the history of the civil rights movement as it happened. It includes two CDs that are narrated by Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee, the actor and actress, but it's written by an old friend, Herb Boyd. And Herb Boyd, as you may remember from other appearances on the Peter Werby Show, is an award-winning author and journalist who has published 11 books and countless articles for national magazines and newspapers. We last interviewed him about his book, which was, I have to find it here among, let me introduce, while I'm looking, I'll introduce my old friend, Herb Boyd. Hi,
yeah.
Herb.
Oh, Herb. Great to be with you.
Yeah.
What is that, Brother Man? Or?
Not Brother Man, we missed that. Brother Man, the Odyssey of Black Men in American Anthology,
yes.
Race and Resistance.
Oh, Race and Resistance, yes.
African Americans in the 21st Century, mm-hmm. And I'm really looking forward to your forthcoming Sugar in Harlem, a biography of Sugar Ray Robinson, the boxer.
Next month.
Oh, really? Well, okay, we'll have to get you on quickly then. We Shall Overcome is one of those books that not only tells the story through narrative, but has an incredible amount of photographs that are stirring and heartening and depressing, and these audio CDs, but also the narrative by you, Herb Boyd. And, you know, Herb, one of the worst questions is people say, why did you write this book? But actually, that is an interesting question, because there's lots of histories of the civil rights movement out. And I wonder, maybe you could explain in this your own personal history. You were raised in Detroit, were you?
Indeed.
So tell us some about that and why you came to this book.
Well, I think what happened is that being in New York, you know, you're right in the heartbeat of the industry. And one of my purposes for moving there in 1985 was essentially to kind of jumpstart my writing career. I had done several books in Detroit, as you know, working on the history of jazz there with the Jazz Research Institute and the Artist Workshop and what have you. But, hey, I wanted to jump out there on a national front, and I had an opportunity, and I moved to New York in 1985. And since then, I guess they said 11 books. Actually, it's 15 books now.
Uh-oh.
It's 15. This is We Shall Overcome is my 14th, and of course the Sugar Ray Robinson book will be the 15th. And what happened with We Shall Overcome, and in fact I talk about it in the author's words to readers,
mm-hmm.
And I say that I did it with a certain amount of reluctance. You know, when they first approached me, the editor, Hill Black, said, hey, let's do this book. Through my agent, he contacted me, and I say, no, not another book on the civil rights movement. Now, what can I do to make it any, more concise or to embellish or enlighten? I say, you know, you can read James Forman's The Making of Black Revolutionaries. You can read all of the Dr. King stuff. You know, John Lewis has it, Andrew Young. I mean, Rosa Parks. I mean, all the books are out there. What do you need from him? He said, well, look, we're talking about a media fusion book. I said, what do you mean by that? He says, this book will be accompanied by two audio CDs. okay, he got my interest. He got my interest right there. And then, Peter, after doing research, it was like an archaeological dig through the civil rights movement. Because another thing I had in mind is that if I'm going to do a book, then we're going to have to update a number of the dramatic stories coming out of that period. For example, the Emmett Till case.
Sure, which now, probably does not resonate with 90% of the Euro-Americans listening.
Indeed. So now the Justice Department, mainly because of two filmmakers, Keith Beauchamp and Stanley Nelson, have both created and developed two fine documentaries that have looked into this case, and so much so that the Justice Department now is very interested in reopening the case. I'm not sure what's going to happen with that, with Ashcroft stepping aside, or maybe it'll even be better.
Herb Boyd, remind us of the Emmett Till case.
Emmett Till was a young black youth, 14 years old, from Chicago, where I am at this point, who ventured down to Mississippi, Money, Mississippi, in 1955. He usually went to Mississippi during the summer to spend vacation time with his relatives there. On this occasion, he, along with four others, including two of his cousins, went to a grocery store, Bryant's Grocery Store. And there they encountered the Carolyn Bryant, who was working there for her husband in the store. And as we know, allegedly, he whistled at her. Now, I was told that, according to Simeon Wright, his cousin, who was with him at that time, that Emmett actually did whistle at her. He actually did. For a long time, it was just allegedly he whistled, that he may have been a stutterer, and he just mistakenly said something that resembled a whistle, that he, you know, was flirted with her, hey, baby, I'm going to take you out. But Simeon Wright, and I had a chance to interview him, he told me exactly what happened. So I was able to update the case. Well, eventually, that morning, early in like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, Roy Bryant and J.W. Mylan, his half-brother, went by Emmett Till's, where Emmett Till was staying with his granduncle, and snatched him out of there and took him away, spirited him off in the night. For 3 days he was missing. Finally, when his body turned up in the Tallahatchie River, Peter, it was battered beyond recognition. And that picture was put in Jet magazine. I saw it as a kid.
Now, that was I was going to ask you. So you must have been like 11, 12, 13
exactly.
years old. And
exactly.
And people forget, at that era, there was a really parallel black culture that was filled with its own community institutions, including publications, which then was called the Negro Press.
Exactly.
So, and you saw that as a youngster.
I saw it. I was like 15 when I saw it, Peter.
You're older than I thought. Okay.
I was 15, right? I was 15 years old when I saw that, and I was just, I mean, his face looked like a potato. I mean, like a battered potato.
Did that frighten you as a young black man?
I didn't know what to make of it until, you know, later on it was explained to me what had happened to him. You know, I figured it was just an accident. And then the full implications and the full explanation of that situation was given to me. My mother put it all in context for me because I was born in Alabama. And she brought my brother and I out of there when we were like 4 and 5 years old, because she didn't want us to go through all of the kind of stuff that she had experienced as a black woman in the South, particularly the kind of racist aggression that she had seen happen time and time again. So all of this brought it back home to her. Mm-hmm. And then through her recognition of the situation, she explained to us and say, look here, I would never send you back down south for no purposes whatsoever.
Well, Herbert, tell us about, actually, let me just keep mentioning the book because people join us as the program goes on. You're listening to The Peter Werby Show. My guest is Detroiter Herb Boyd, who has written this absolutely crucial, what's the word I'm looking at here? You got to fill me in.
I think what happens is that, you know, it's an attempt to really dramatize you a number of the, and give you the emotional connection to some of these events that some people know nothing about and others know a little bit about.
Well, it's the history of the civil rights movement.
Sure.
And, you know, I've been recently reading, like I read Kevin Boyle's book, Arc of Justice, about the Ocean Sweet case.
Just won the National Book Award.
Oh, amazing book. And then a little stodgier but still filled with information, Thomas Grew's Urban Crisis about Detroit. And how close was Detroit when you were growing up? In the late late 40s and the 50s, mm-hmm. to what your mother was fleeing. How did you feel as a young black child and then a teen and into adulthood?
Well, you know, the South was, of course, quite removed. I came out, we were in Black Bottom. And from Black Bottom, we moved to the North End, and from the North End, we moved out to 8 Mile Road. Matter of fact, when we moved out to 8 Mile Road, there was a wall that went right down our backyard, and that was a wall of separation of the races.
Were you living in Royal Oak Township?
No, it was on the other side of 8 Mile Road.
Okay. Oh, on the south?
Yeah, I was on the other side, you know. I was on what you call the Detroit side.
Okay.
That was the Ferndale side.
Right.
So I was living right on Pinehurst. And in Mendota, there was a wall that ran down the back of the houses on Mendota, Peter. I think that wall is still there.
Huh.
It's about 6 feet high.
Wow.
And about 3.5 to 4 feet thick. And we used to walk that wall. And we never understood why that wall was there until some people began to explain to us that that wall was built to separate the communities.
Well, you know, I was just talking to a couple of gay men who live on my street, and they mm-hmm. were so angry about this vote in Michigan that essentially said that they were less than human beings,
mm-hmm.
and over this so-called defense of marriage amendment that went in. So you all of a sudden, as a kid, got the information that you weren't a full human being, or you were not. What does that do to a consciousness?
I know what happened is that it's kind of a slow accumulation of the actual discrimination and the racism that you encounter that comes in increments, and there's a slight, what you call the slights that you receive, and sometimes you don't even understand, you know, why are they saying that? Because I went to guest school, I went to presentation, I went to Mumford, I was like the only black at guest school. I was the first over there on Finkel and Myers. I was the first black student to go to that school, among the first. It was like three or four of us. The Binion family came and at last rescued me and gave me some kind of connection.
Binion, I know him, and I can't think of his first name.
Okay, you got Tom Binion?
Tom, yeah, sure.
Yeah, the Binions moved in from Mississippi on Monta Vista and Manor.
Huh.
And that kind of like, it was like 14 to 21 of them got out of a truck, Peter. And that was like, wow, you know, it was like a whole neighborhood moved in at one time. And that was relief for us because we were alone out there. So Mary and Russell, who are the older Binions, they went to school with me. And we were like the only blacks at these schools. And we heard all these names hurled at us. I mean, it got me interested in languages because I didn't know what they were calling me and what was going on here. But I heard all these different kind of insinuations and very derogatory remarks, these insults, and it just attuned me, and my antenna went up, and it stayed up for a long time, and very sensitive to any kind of racial slights. And after a while, you know, it's a certain kind of callous forms, and you have to become really hard and tough. Otherwise, you just be torn apart. You know, you can't stand up against these constant insults, somebody, you know, dehumanizing you at every turn. So after a while, I mean, I just got really tough. I became a student of my history and culture. And eventually that added up to me doing the research and doing the writing and everything. And I remember those years, you know, when I was considered like, you know, little black Sambo in the classroom. And when every time they talk about slavery, everybody in the classroom would turn around and look at me.
Well, I don't know if We Shall Overcome is Herb Boyd's revenge or what. It's certainly a contribution to our understanding of a good portion of American history. Can you extrapolate and expand your individual experience from the people that you chronicle in We Shall Overcome? I should say, by the way, too, it's a source book. It's accompanied by two CDs narrated by the actors Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee as well. You know, the story of the civil rights movement has been told a lot, but I think a lot of people see it kind of like, particularly as we recede advance into history, it's like half a century ago, and it's almost to people today, it's almost like, you know, reading about George Washington.
Ancient history.
We won the revolution, and then we also had this horrible situation with segregation and discrimination, and then now we've overcome it and all of that. But you described yourself. You think that was a generalized experience for the icons of the movement, the Martin Luther Kings and the Rosa Parks?
Probably even more so for them, because here, you know, when I was a young man with the opportunity to go down there, I had no I say, look here, ain't no way in the world I'm going down there. First of all, I didn't believe in that particular philosophy.
Of nonviolence.
The passive non-resistance and all that. I mean, the passive resistance and nonviolence and what have you. And I mean, those sit-ins and Freedom Rides and everything where they were just trained not to respond to any attacks on them. I was just unheard of because I was pretty much in the camp with Malcolm X, who believed in by any means necessary.
Well, you knew Malcolm X, also.
Indeed, I did. You know, as a teenager, I spent many time going to the mosque. I was a member of the Nation of Islam.
Really?
Oh yes. And when Malcolm left in 1963-64, I also left. You know, and I was through with that. And I was going to hook up with Malcolm if I came out of the service, but he was assassinated about 1 week before I was scheduled to go to New York and join him.
In your book, Herb Boyd, mm-hmm. We Shall Overcome, you tell the story of Malcolm X going down to Selma, where mm-hmm. Maybe you could relate that. I think that's an extraordinary story.
Well, it was only an attempt to hook up with Dr. King. Of course, it didn't happen because, you know, Dr. King was in jail at that time. But they did meet again in Washington, D.C., and that was the only meeting that they ever had. So that was Malcolm beginning to show some kind of concern about what was happening to the young people going down there. And when he went down there, he met with Coretta King, and they discussed, and he let her know, and Coretta talks about it in her autobiography, how warm and sympathetic he was, and she just found him completely different from the public image that had been promoted about him. And so from there, later on, when Fannie Lou Hamer, in 1964, when Fannie Lou Hamer came to New York City, again, Malcolm was with her on a panel, and they communicated very well. And it began to show a different kind of outlook that Malcolm had about the civil rights movement. Of course, before then, he considered, like, the 1963, the March on Washington. He called it the farce on Washington.
This was after he had left Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam and went to Mecca and had a more generalized...
Just before that, because we are talking about, you know, 1963.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but then gradually he's, I think his whole different, going to Mecca was a part of his forming a different kind of perspective, certainly about the nature and the role of a Muslim and Islam, you know, from a fundamental standpoint or orthodox standpoint, as opposed to being a member of the Nation of Islam. But then again, I think that King and Malcolm, if you look, if their lives could have been lived out a bit longer, I think politically and ideologically, they were on a trajectory of convergence. I think they were coming together.
Well, I was going to actually ask that. The publicists always send out these questions, I guess for talk show hosts, they think, can't think of any themselves. And here's one I wouldn't ask, but I would change a little. It says, this February marks the 40th anniversary of Malcolm X's assassination. If he were here today, what would he say in retrospect about the movement? But here's what I would put to you, Herb mm-hmm. Boyd. I would turn that question to you. You said at the time, I mean, Malcolm X said at one time that he would be nonviolent when he meets up with nonviolence.
Exactly.
So here we had mostly this passive resistance and sit-ins and what have you. How do you assess what occurred and your own feelings at the time as compared to now? Are you any softer towards what occurred then?
Oh, and no doubt about it. In doing this here book, in doing We Shall Overcome, I was completely convinced that these people, these young people in particular, and I think our young audience today need to pay attention to this, is that they made the ultimate sacrifice and commitment to go down there. When you talk about Ashwerner, Goodman, and Cheney, you know, the three men who were killed, you know, by these Kluxers or Knight Riders or, you know, these racist reactionaries.
Actually, they were the sheriff.
Exactly.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
So-called, you know, defenders. It's like Mississippi Burning the film did, Peter,
yeah.
You know, to make the FBI look like heroes, and it's absolutely ridiculous. So you have, like, the Stokely Carmichaels, the Rap Browns, the Robert Moses, you know, the Diane Nash, the John Lewis's, all these young people, and they were teenagers. They were, like, you know, fresh out of high school, some of them, just their first or second year in college. Nonetheless, they were so concerned about voter registration. They were so concerned about ending, you know, the kind of American apartheid that they went down there, and some of them paid the ultimate price. When you talk about a Viola Liuzzo, she was at Wayne State University. She was the only white woman who was killed during the Civil Rights Movement. She had five children. Mm-hmm. She left her family. She left her education. She left her job. She went down there, and she was killed as a result of, like, ferreting. She was, like, ferrying, you know, black people from Selma after they had made the march from Selma to Montgomery, and going down the highway when a car pulled up along her with FBI agent in it, an undercover agent, you know, Gary Rowe, and they fired on her and killed her. So, I mean, they have a film, her daughter has made or was a part of a documentary called Home of the Brave that talks about her commitment, the dedication that she gave to the movement. So it's those kind of people, you know, and I was doing the research, almost each stratum introduced me to another gem, another precious life, you know, that was involved in the struggle. And that just turned me around. You know, before, you know, I used to talk about the Civil Rights Movement, but, you know, being a Malcolmite and everything, you know, my concern was more with, you know, hey, you hit me, I'll send you to the cemetery.
Yeah, it's extraordinary when you think, too, the amount of deaths that occurred in the 1960s. I mean, actually, in the 1930s, 300 working people were killed by sheriffs and cops and National Guardsmen, and just trying to unionize. And,
oh, sure.
And the amount of violence that we saw in the 1960s was certainly horrendous. We only have a little bit of time left, and as I we're interviewing Herb Boyd and his about his extraordinary new book for Source Books, We Shall Overcome. It has two CDs with it about a lot of the source material.
It's kind of like a veritable soundtrack of the Civil Rights movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, so far I've been asking an easy question. Here's, you know, usually, and I didn't know all the, I kind of knew enough to ask the questions, and here's a really a tough one. Why do we still have race as a problem today? We had the Civil Rights Movement. We got rid of all these Kluxers. We don't have these racists supposedly sitting in the Senate trying to block legislation. We don't have governors standing in the way of university doors. Mm-hmm. Why are we still talking about race today?
Because it's still highly prevalent, and racism is highly prevalent. Sometimes it's a bit more subtle and nuanced today, but it manifests itself in so many different ways. Look at the recent election, Peter. You know, in which, you know, various ways, you know, you used to talk about disenfranchisement in as much as a poll tax or literacy test or a grandfather clause. But now you find other kind of ways to deny people an opportunity to exercise their franchise. You know, so it's very subtle, it's very nuanced. I mean, police brutality is alive and well in America. The whole disparity in terms of pay, the opportunities, you know. I mean, we still need, you know, affirmative action as far as I'm concerned out there, although some may deny that. Remember, the title of this book is say, We Shall Overcome.
Mm-hmm.
We have not overcome yet. You know, we still have a large amount of things to do in terms of bringing equality and full freedom into society for our minorities in particular.
Now, the conservatives say that leading the forces of tolerance and what have you are they, the Republicans. They've appointed Condoleezza Rice as Secretary of State, replacing another African-American. And
that's kind of cynical manipulation of race right there, as far as I'm concerned.
Is it, you know, if race... is race ultimately cultural? I mean, in other words, we know of musicians that they say that are white but have lived black, and they were always related to as they were African Americans. And I mean, if in many ways you could say about Condoleezza Rice, couldn't you, that they virtually have adopted and people are free to do what they want. I'm not critical of them
this.
But essentially adopted a Euro-American culture.
That's right. They adopt, they fall, they conform, they're co-opted and what have you. Many of them are paid off quite handsomely for doing that, and they have every reason. It may be their deep desires, and I wouldn't want to at all disparage that. You know, people can go ahead and determine which way they want to go. That's their own decision. But, you know, you have people out there who are very much, you know, hey, I got a price, and you can get me for that. And they really believe that, you know, being a part of the kind of Christian conservative movement out there, you can strike a particular moral value issue that will resonate very well with them. You know, I mean, I think the what happened with this year past election is a clear indication that, you know, hey, race is very much apparent, and they play that race card all the time. You know, I mean, Rove is a supreme strategist. You know, when you go to the excerpts of this here country, you begin to talk about the empire of Christianity. When you, for me, you know, the interpretation of, you know, you generation of vipers, you know, that the whole question, the Pharisees are in the White House at last. The Pharisees are in the White House. And these people, the whole evil axis out there, and then you have like a Massachusetts Supreme Court that came down with this, you know, the same-sex marriage thing, you know, like, boom. So 11 states can chime in on that. You know, these are Democratic Party workers and leaders and activists and stuff going into the black pulpit, but not going into the white pulpits. They better take their blackberries and go to Mayberry. That's what's happening.
Her boy, as always, a pleasure to have you on the show. The book is We Shall Overcome, filled with this incredible history of the struggle for human rights. Just the photographs alone are almost worth it. The narrative makes it whole by Herb Boyd. And then two CDs narrated by actors Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee. And I'm hoping, Herb, that we're going to have you back real soon to talk about your forthcoming book, Sugar in Harlem, the biography of the boxer Sugar Ray Robinson.
That would be my pleasure. And of course, when we have our event in Detroit, maybe I can appear again on Riff and talk to you about that particular event.
I'm there.
Okay, thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
OSI Pro Series WREF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champion. Call 248-591-6841 today. Brought to you by OSI Pro Series Professional Grade Caulk Sealants and Adhesives. Complete battery source. Every battery for every need. And 101 WREF.
Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix, the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-824-6692. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. Call now for a brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more. 1-800-824-6692. Programs vary by campus. Call University of Phoenix now. 1-800-824-6692. That's 1-800-824-6692.
HD. High Definition Radio. Hear the future of radio now.
Riff rocks.
101 WRIF Detroit.
Chemicals, oh mama, I'm sure all the hen and I just around. Action speaks louder than words, and I'm a man, a great experience. I know you got another man, but I can love you better than him. Take my hand, don't be afraid, I'm gonna prove every word I say. I'm advertising love for free, so you can play show. Candlecoals and mama, I'm sure all the henna now just around. Candle calls a mama, I'm sure.